Let me briefly introduce myself. I think I know many of you, but not all of you. I became a believer at a place we love named La Brie in 1964, and have my, you know, career has been in three major portions. I started out as a school teacher in a wonderful high school in Greenwich, Connecticut, and got quite involved with youth ministry there. And it was not a Christian school, but they gave me great freedom to teach and to, you know, help disciple some of the young people. And then I was asked to teach apologetics in Aix-en-Provence at the Reformed Seminary there. I grew up in France, so I have French, and they needed an apologetics professor. So we spent 11 wonderful years suffering in Aix-en-Provence. And then since that time, I've been teaching apologetics at Westminster Theological Seminary, which is a graduate school of theology near Philadelphia. And my interest is in cultural apologetics. I've been involved at the Trinity Forum almost since the beginning. One of my dearest friends in the world is Oz Guinness, who's actually here this week with us. And he got us involved as what they call moderators. And I'm going to explain a little bit how it all works out, but we've been working with the Trinity Forum for some 20-plus years, and it's a unique ministry. It's a rather amazing approach to bringing leaders together and helping them to discover how Christ can be at the center of their leadership. As we will see, it's indirect and it's inductive, but it's no less Christian for that matter. This afternoon we're gonna go through a few texts from one of the favorite curricula. So the Trinity Forum has an interesting history. It came from an insight in the late 70s, around the time that America was celebrating the 200th anniversary of its founding documents. And as you may know, the First Amendment to the Constitution contains certain key statements that have been a guide in North America. And one of them is the so-called disestablishment of the church clause. And there are others such as freedom of speech, freedom to assemble, and so on. And it seemed to a number of key leaders in America, and I think from Europe as well, that this would be an opportune moment to, it seemed a moment, an important moment to revisit the First Amendment and particularly focus on the issue of how can people from different faiths and backgrounds and deep religious differences live together, not despite their differences, but as a way to express freedom. And so they wrote a document that's called the Williamsburg Charter, because it was written in Williamsburg, Virginia, a place important in American history. And it was so impactful, it had such a tremendous influence, that the leaders who wrote it together thought, we should continue this work in some form. And so they conceived, and Oz Guinness was one of the main people, there were a couple of others as well, of an outreach to be called the Trinity Forum, whose mission would be to change culture by transforming its leaders. And they want to keep this emphasis on standing for your position in a highly pluralistic world. So from the beginning, their first real outreach was to develop these rich curricula on a particular theme. There's seven or eight of them out now. This one is a foundational one, The Journey, but they have others. They have One on the problem of evil, which is called "But Not Through Me," was a quote from Solzhenitsyn. There's one on charity, which is called "The Wise Art of Giving." It's an approach to philanthropy. There's one on being named Entrepreneurs for Life, and each of them, the idea is to take leaders or potential leaders away from their work for sometimes just a weekend, or sometimes 10 days, or sometimes once a week for a period of time, and to walk them through these curricula from beginning to end. And as you'll see, as you can see already, they are based on the use of marvelous texts, many of them from the canon of Western literature, some from the scripture, some from modern pundits and so forth, and to basically read these through. And you're supposed to come having read them, but it doesn't usually happen that way with busy executives. So what we devised was the idea we're just going to have somebody read a few portions and then comment on them, and then discuss them. It's meant to be inductive, and one of the hardest things for the moderator is to hold back. These are not lectures, and the moderator is meant to encourage participants to discover the riches of these texts for himself or herself. And to help with that process, we introduce each section, and then we have the readings, and then there are diagnostic questions at the end. And you're not bound by them. The moderator is perfectly free to handle it different ways. But we found that these preset questions are good ways to begin. And then the great hope is that the group will begin to feel comfortable with itself, and we'll be able to take discussions down different rabbit trails. And again, the moderator's job is to let that happen, but without excess. And so I've been to, I don't know how many scores of these fora, and they're each different depending on the chemistry of the group, but they're remarkably rich. And our ultimate hope is that through these explorations, these persons will, if they're not believers, will be attracted to the Christian faith. And we've seen people commit themselves to Christ in these explorations. If they are believers, to go deeper and to better to bring the Lordship of Christ to bear on their particular specialty or their discipline, whatever that might be. And I'll tell you an amusing incident which gives you the flavor of it, but just in a funny anecdotal way. Barbara and I were at one of these fora, I forget which curriculum we used, in Colorado somewhere, and there's a big family in Colorado called Coors, and they are beer brewers, and they make these beers called Coors Light and so forth, and most of them are wonderful Christian people. And so we were going through, I forget which text, and we're saying, you know, you need to apply the Lordship of Christ to every discipline, and including to your own. And so I overheard Pete Coors whisper to his neighbor, you know, I'm a beer peddler. How can I bring the Lordship of Christ to bear? And the guy, without losing a beat, said, make better beers. I think he was in favor of more Guinness type of beers and so forth. But, you know, that's just an example. It's a trivial example of how we want people to come to a more serious discipleship in their disciplines. I'll tell you this: the great idea of the Trinity Forum remains a great idea. But in the early 90s, I guess when we began this thing, we thought it was going to turn the world upside down, because our motto is transforming culture by transforming leadership, and you know, the good news is that many people got involved, and it's been an inspiration to lots and lots of folks. The bad news is that culture, as far as we can tell, has not been overwhelmingly transformed. And we've thought about why, you know. I mean, there are people who challenge this approach. They will say it's elitist because, you know, you're reading Plato and you're reading Goethe and, you know, how many people have access to that? And so what we try to answer is this isn't for everybody, but we do want people to consider the tradition and the classics and to adhere to the discipline of reading them carefully and then discussing them with, and hopefully owning them. And another criticism is that most of this is written. And we've responded that, yeah, we're working on that. We're going to try to make more things available in terms of images, film discussion, music. For the moment, it's very much tied to the written word. But we're not ashamed of that. We're just thinking we need to go further. And then the third criticism, which was a sociological one, is that often, you know, it's the retired or about to retire senior executives who are free enough and wealthy enough to go out on a big weekend and to sit and ponder these texts. And those aren't the people who are really going to transform culture. It's the 30-somethings, you know, who are just on the foothills of that kind of management leadership. And so we've very consciously tried to address younger people without leaving out the older ones. And we've had some success with that. You know, there's an association in America called Young Presidents, and there's others. And so we've been encouraged to see that a number of groups, which are made up of junior leaders and executives and so forth, have desired to have the Trinity Forum approach, and we're just happy to see them do that. So this is a ministry. It's not the only one by any means. It's been remarkably helpful to many people on many levels. I regularly use this material in my classes, for example. It's perfect for education. And there are many other uses that you can find for them. So that's a very brief history of the
Trinity.
Okay, I could mention that. It's sort of related. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that's right. Good point. One answer to the challenge of reaching younger people is that several of the board members decided to create an academy, a very unusual academy. It takes place over 9 months, September to May. We have an amazing property that a wealthy real estate man gave us on the eastern side of the Chesapeake Bay. It was the old fellowship house, which is the prayer breakfast people, but they didn't use it anymore. It was going south, and so this man purchased it, and we've fixed it up. And so now we have a program with 12 fellows, six men, six women, who live in a big old house, and there's a sort of senior couple there. It's not unlike LaBrie in some ways. It's a little more structured maybe, but it's not unlike LaBrie. And then we teach a three-part curriculum to them: spiritual formation combined with theology, Bible, and worship, sociology of knowledge, and then history of ideas. That sounds more rigid than it really is. We divide life into those three, but we also bring in lots of guests who have expertise in some area, the arts, or you know, one of the favorite of our guests is a car salesman, Christian, showing you how to do that with grace. I mean, just so it's a very popular program. You have to have been a college graduate, and generally they're between the ages of 23 or so and about 30. And they take it's free. I mean, we fund it, but it's free for them. And they are shaped by this kind of material and other things that we bring, and it's a remarkable experience. And now this is 10 years in, and we've seen some of them go into leadership in significant ways in government and in business. business and so on. So, yeah, if let me just pause before we go into just start doing these texts. Does anybody have any questions about the Trinity Forum, just the concept or the practice or the nature of it? Or
how do non-Christians who come to a forum respond to it? Do you get a mixture?
We do, and we love it when they come because we hope that this will be attractive to them in a way that maybe other approaches to evangelism might not work.
Mm-hmm. But do they see it as they're coming to a Christian evangelistic program?
We say it in our documents that we are Christ-centered, but we don't use the word evangelism, though we're happy for people to become Christians, and that's what we would love. So we're not hiding anything, but they usually come because some friend said, you know, you really need this, you need to come, and it's just great, and they're great people, and you probably don't realize that there are others who are asking questions and that kind of thing. So they're drawn in, and so it's very soft sell, if you will. There's an optional devotional time early in the morning, but you know, you don't have to come. And so, but most of the people who come have either become Christians or have some strong inclinations in that direction. Mm-hmm. We've had the odd atheist and everything, and that's really fun. Yeah, that's a good question.
So they tend to be fringe people rather than anti-theists or atheists.
They're on the foothills. Yeah, I mean, yeah. We have had some hostile people, but it doesn't take long. See, along with Oz Guinness, who's one of the world thinkers, one of the founding people was Alonzo MacDonald, and he was the head of McKinsey Europe, and then he became Jimmy Carter's staff head for the White House, and he's done so many things. So you can't say, oh, these are wimpy Christians, you know, who are beating the Bible. These are world class people who have tremendous credibility. Mm-hmm. And Al became a believer later in life, and he usually at dinner, you know, he'll give his testimony, and it's unbelievable. You know, so you can't take this and caricature Christianity. You might not like it, and you might be afraid of it, or you might think it's misguided approach. But you know, you can't call it shallow or something like that.
So, yeah. Bill, how do you summarize how those non-Christians end up coming? How do you get them? What really is attracting them?
The most common recruiting, which is not a good word, is just friendship and word of mouth. In fact, we used to joke that at the beginning, almost all of it was populated by Al MacDonald's Rolodex from his McKinsey days, you know. And it's so much fun because you see these people who are out there in the trenches, and you know, some of them remarkable. I mean, the vice chair of the board is Ed Meese, who used to be Ronald Reagan's attorney general, and so you're in with. It's been accused of elitism, and there probably is a little of that sense, but we don't mean to be. But it is a rarefied group that usually isn't reached by other means. Okay, so this is one of our curricula, it's been. This one's been published by NAV Press. They haven't all been published. The usual format when we gather is a ring binder notebook like this, and so you can go back and forth and take notes. And there's no one way to do it, but the typical format is to get people around a big table. And it's usually two moderators because it's kind of tiring. And then there's a central kind of president moderator who just is a timekeeper and introduces things. And so what we do is someone will start and will just introduce the curriculum. So this published form introduces the journey, and it does so. Oz, I think, wrote most of this, But it describes the journey or the odyssey of many people who have struggle with whether how you ask the right questions in order to get the right answers. In this introduction, for example, Chesterton is quoted saying, "We all feel the riddle of earth without anyone to point it out. The mystery of life is the plainest part of it." So it's a it's encouraging people to see that we're on a journey. And it talks about nostalgia and C.S. Lewis's famous Sehnsucht. But it introduces Moby Dick and all these people who are searching and questing. Incidentally, in the format that we give out, I don't know if it came out in the printout, but it's pot full of quotes from all kinds of people. You know, Václav Havel's letters to Olga it's in these marginal notes. "The tragedy of modern man is not that he knows less and less about the meaning of his own life, but that it bothers him less and less." And it's just got these marvelous gems, you know. So it introduces the general curriculum, and then this particular one is divided into four sections. And each section has a dozen or so texts. So in the case of the journey, the first section is called A Time for Questions. The second, A Time for Answers. Third, A Time for Evidences. And fourth, A Time for Commitment. So you can see it's moving from questions to various types of answers. And then how do you choose? And then when are you going to make up your mind kind of thing. In the first one, A Time for Questions, it's texts from all kinds of people who have been jolted into asking questions or who have been provoked or whose experience has led him or her to, you know, wonder about life. The second, The Time for Answers, focuses on the problem of evil. Now, we have an entire curriculum on the problem of evil, but this one just takes that issue and shows generally three groups of answers to the problem of evil. One group comes from an Asian kind of mindset, another from a more Stoic mindset, and then a third from a Christian or Judeo-Christian mindset. Again, nobody's being asked to make a commitment or being forced into it. They're exploring. And then the third is A Time for Evidences, which is there any compelling evidence in favor or against the Christian answer? And then finally, an appeal for people to make some kind of commitment. The last reading we're going to do, if we have time, will be from Von Moltke, who was the great... from a great dissident noble family in Germany that separated from the Nazis and because of their Christian convictions. So let's just plunge right into this. The Time for Questions. This is a section that kind of asks you to think about things. And there's an introduction with what we call points to ponder. We go through this relatively rapidly because people are supposed to have read some of this before they come to it. People who come are encouraged to search for the truth for reasons that may be obvious for Christians but aren't obvious for a lot of people, even Christians who are perhaps just on the foothills. And so significantly, the first... kind of text we use is Plato's Parable of the Cave. And most of you will know this parable because it shows up in every philosophy book, it shows up in high school books and so forth. Plato, along with his mentor Socrates and their disciple Aristotle, was one of the defining philosophers of the West. Someone once said, every philosopher in the West is a footnote to Plato. And he lived in very difficult times, and he sought solace or a cure from his ills, not in the usual ways, but in philosophy. And if you know the general contours of Plato's philosophy, he talked of an ideal world, and then a world below which has forgotten or needs to remember the ideal world. And while not a Christian, he was a great influence on the church, because many of the Christian apologists thought that he was, you know, very insightful about the forgetting of the real world. So, the parable of the cave. Let's begin, and if you're okay with this, I'd like to ask you to just read a portion of it. Nick, can I start with you?
And yeah, I have it too.
You have it here? It starts, "And now I said..."
"And now I said, let me show in a figure how far our nature is enlightened or unenlightened. Behold, human beings living in an underground den, which has a mouth open towards the light and reaching all along the den. Here they have been from their childhood and have their legs and necks chained so that they cannot move and can only see before them, being prevented by the chains from turning round their heads. Above and behind them a fire is blazing at a distance, and between the fire and the prisoners there is a raised way. And you will see, if you look, a low wall built along the way, like the screen which marionette players have in front of them, over which they show their puppets." "I see. And do you see," I said, "men passing along the wall, carrying all sorts of vessels and statues and figures of animals made of wood and stone and various materials, which appear over the wall? Some of them are talking, others silent."
So, this is a parable for obvious reasons. Could one of you describe the scene in your own words? Just what's the basic image here? What are the components of it? Who are these strange pioneers? Well, where are they all located?
Well, they're down in a cave, and they can't see behind them the people walking. All they can see in front of them are the shadows, and all they can hear are the echoes. And their whole experience is one of shadows and echoes of a reality that's behind them.
Good, good. So, as Plato understands it, what does this say about knowledge? You know, human knowledge, presumably without the light of revelation.
This light is not sufficient to deliver it.
Yeah. It's a shadow, but it's not the real thing. Okay. Anything else? Why, I mean, you don't want to overplay this thing, but why are they called strange prisoners? Do you suppose? Well,
they're held captive by the chains, so they can't move. So they've got a limited view of reality.
Yeah.
And they're prisoners in their own experience, in their own... which is purely from their own perception.
So for Plato, is this good or is this bad? I mean, why is Plato particularly interested in thinking of them as captives? Remember what I said about the ideals and
they have to be liberated.
Yeah, they have to be liberated. They have to remember. Jimmy, you want to read the next one? It's from...
"You have shown me a strange image, and they are strange prisoners. Like ourselves," I replied, "they see only their own shadows, or the shadows of one another. which the fire throws on the opposite wall of the cave. True, he said. How could they see anything but the shadows if they were never allowed to move their heads? Now the objects which are being carried in like manner, they would only see the shadows? To them, I said, the truth would be literally nothing but the shadows of the images. That is certain. And now look again and see what will naturally follow if the prisoners are released and disabused of their error. At first, when any of them is liberated and compelled suddenly to stand up and turn his neck round and walk and look towards the light, he will suffer sharp pains. The glare will distress him, and he will be unable to see the realities of which, in his former state, he had seen the shadows.
Mm-hmm. So how does this contribute to deepening the parable or the image? So how does this business about turning your neck around and then you see and your eyes are dazzled, how does that add to this image?
That it's overwhelming and even painful to actually see beyond the shadows and echoes with which one's become familiar.
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe you want to avoid that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's too much, too soon. Yeah. You want to go slowly. Okay. So I'm not going to, go through line by line, but this text brings the reader to a place where they can begin to have the ability to see. He calls it a beatific vision. And then he freely brings in a moral dimension, calling the divine contemplation a stark contrast to the evil state of man. And again, while not Christian, it certainly reminds us of certain portions of Scripture where that contrast is made. Can anyone think of a place in, or maybe two or three in Scripture, where the presence of the light only highlights the darkness of the human condition? Where does the Bible do that? Maybe on every page, but there's some particularly strong places where
Saul's conversion.
Okay, good. Paul, who was Saul before, road to Damascus, recorded in Acts 9 and other places. What did he see, or rather, what happened to him when he tried to look at it?
He went blind.
Went blind, right. And what about that as a metaphor as well as a reality? Can you give examples of this in either other parts of Scripture or just in your own experience? Do you know people, or has it ever happened to you, where suddenly seeing something utterly true has given you a sense, or your friend who has experienced this, a sense of actually being blind? What is it, about the truth that can render people not more enlightened, but utterly ignorant?
Or utterly afraid.
Fear is a very important one, I think. Yeah.
When I first saw the truth of the gospel as a PhD student in economics and its answer for the economic problem, I got scared.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
I understood, yes, this is the answer. This is the truth that I'm looking for. Uh-huh. I got so scared, I slammed the book shut. Mm-hmm. I hid the Bible. Mm-hmm. And ran away.
Yeah.
I couldn't take it. Yeah. I couldn't take to bear the truthness of it, the lightness of it.
What was it, a professor talk to you about?
I didn't know there were any other Christians in this world from my very liberal background.
Yeah.
Okay. I saw I had no comfort to turn to.
That's
the professors were not interested in hearing anything. Mm. I was called the dodo bird from Alice in Wonderland.
Oh.
The one who doesn't know reality from non-reality.
Wow. Yeah. That is fascinating. C.S. Lewis had fear, didn't he, when he knew he had to yield, because he, I think, legitimately realized it would cost him professionally. But I think at a deeper level, it also meant, you know, this is scary stuff. Mm-hmm. And many of us resent some of the evangelists who try to make Christianity so palpable and easy and make God into a grandfather, you know, that when people do become believers, and then it's a very bad dream when they wake up and realize he's not quite so soft and meek. He can be, but he's also a great fire. I also think of Peter when Jesus said, you know, cast your nets down, and they'd been working all night and couldn't get anything, and it was so full that the net miraculously kept all that catch. And Peter, you know, he did not say, oh, wonderful, Lord, thanks for being here. You know, he said, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man. And this is Peter. This is not just some... So Plato has, I think he's caught something of this, even though he's pre-Christian. He knows. So this is just but one illustration of a way to ask questions when you feel close to, you know, the holy or something. Your first reaction is not to be comfortable, but to be uncomfortable. And ultimately, Plato and his philosophy will ask people to leave the cave and go out and see not the shadows but the sun, which again is a Christian insight.
Why did Plato write all this?
Two reasons. I mean, there are probably more, but one was that he was skeptical about the easy answers from mythology. So philosophy was a skeptical move. And the second is that he needed solace in wise reflection. And he felt that many people sought solace in drinking or wealth or, you know, whatever. And he thought, no, if I'm going to be honest, I'm going to find solace in great thoughts. And he was a teacher. You know, as I say, philosophy is a footnote to him in the sense that he could ask all these questions. And he often wrote in dialogues like this one, because the dialogue is a question, diagnostic question way that doesn't just, you know, dump the bale of hay on you, but draws you in, you know. So, yeah. Let's look at another text, quite different. Yeah, go ahead, please.
I've taught this many times with non-Christians, and I find that often some non-Christians will begin to see, you know, this as a parallel of the gospel as you're talking about. And it's interesting, isn't it, where Plato says, if someone is led out, mm-hmm. And goes out, sees the light, mm-hmm. then comes in and tries to set them free, mm-hmm. they will kill him.
Yeah.
And here's 400 years before Christ.
Yes.
Some will see it that way, but I find that many others see it as actually the opposite way around. Mm-hmm. That this actually describes my own experience of I was born in this Christian culture and forced to go to church and stuff, and I saw what I was told was reality, which was all about religious observance and going to church. And then I decided to stop being, you know, stop believing in God, and the liberation I felt, mm-hmm. when I stopped believing in God and realized I could be an atheist is it mm-hmm. fits exactly the same, mm-hmm. with the same parable. And actually, when I then saw the light, it was painful to let go of that comfort of believing in God. If I then go back and try to find these Christians and set them free from this religious, you know, things that are like chains holding them captive, then they want to kill me intellectually, emotionally, so on and so forth. And they actually interpret exactly the same parable as a pro-atheist text.
Yeah, go ahead.
So the narrative here is about the move from darkness to light, and that journey can go in either direction, as
what they would say.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think both.
Experience you've had in the community forum with it.
We mostly have had the former, but because most people who come to us haven't been chained up by the church, so I suppose we get some of them. But I could see how both of those would legitimately be provoked by this image of Plato. I think if Plato were in the room, he would have preferred the former reaction because he didn't think that coming to the light meant a liberation from the into nothingness or pure freedom or, you know, freedom as a negative. I think he thought that it would be freedom to believe in the good, admittedly not fully defined and all, but and through reason, through the logos. So I think he would probably rather people see the former parallel than the latter, because he was sure there was truth and there was a God, you know. But I can see how both could be experienced that way.
Well, I remember one time we were at a family wedding and some relative came up and said to us, oh, we now know what you mean by being born again.
Oh, yes.
And we were just like, whoa, family member? It's kind of faith, you know, because we don't come from Christian background. Well, it turns out that he had come out of the closet.
Right.
You know, and that he had embraced the gay lifestyle positively, that he felt he was liberated and, you know, he'd seen the light. And he tagged onto it the born-again language, which was happening, this was, what, 20 years ago?
Yeah, and he'd probably read the same passage.
Yes.
And, like, just through his own interpretation.
Using the Christian language.
And a text like this, its only purpose in this curriculum is to show how people can be, as it were, in the dark because they're only seeing shadows, but you just know there's something greater out there. If you make a whole lot more of it than that, then you're probably putting words into Plato's mouth. He would have said the goodness will liberate you, that pure reason will liberate you, which is not a particularly Christian approach, but it's closer than you know, just atheists. No, I don't have to have shackles.
I work with a number of people who try to use the narrative that way, growing up in a Christian background, and now I move to the light, I'm a non-believer, etc. Another move could be, oh, I've grown up in a Christian background, and I've experienced such a poverty of expression of the Christian faith, and now I finally am enabled to see a more living expression of the Christian faith, would likewise be a journey in a different way than the narrative.
Let's look at another one, rather different. Blaise Pascal, who was a committed Christian, of course. If you are not familiar with him, you have a treat coming, because he's a remarkable man. His story is tragic in that he died young and he was very ill. But in a very short life, he managed to revolutionize solid geometry. He most likely is the originator of the barometer. He was a precursor of differential calculus. But his main interest was in defending the faith. And he had a couple of what we would call conversion experiences. I don't like that term very much because it sounds like conversion is an experience rather than a reality. One of them was he was in a chariot or a horse cart, and it fell almost over to the brink of the water crossing a bridge, and he just got out by the skin of his teeth, and he knew at that time that God was after him. His life's project was a compendium of apologetics thoughts. It was meant to be probably finished into a whole book with paragraphs, but he died early. And what they found were in his desk drawer these groups of texts that he had tied together, and in a certain order. The order has been disputed, but they think they've got it right now. And it's called Les Pensées in French. I read it as a boy because it helped. It was a literature form that was so beautiful that it helped modernize French. I don't know that my teachers realized it was meant to be an appeal to the faith to outsiders, although it'd be pretty hard to miss. And in the Pensée, one of his most famous arguments is the wager, which you can think what you might of it. It's again meant to be more provocative than a final way to look at things, but he's appealing to the nobles and the businessmen of his day, and he's saying, look, there's only two options. God exists or he doesn't exist. And there's only two responses to those options. You believe it or you don't. So if first... Hey, welcome. If at first... do you have another text you can give him? Oh, you have it. He's got it on the computer. Never mind. Good. We did Plato, and now we're looking at Blaise Pascal. So if you believe in God and he does exist, you've won. If you believe in God and he doesn't exist, well, you haven't wasted your life particularly. You've probably, been a good person. If you don't believe in God and he doesn't exist, well, you've been right, but you haven't had much of a life. The big one to avoid is if you don't believe in God and he does exist, you're in serious trouble. So he was kind of appealing to them almost as a business deal, as an investment. And it's he never meant it to be a complete proof. This text comes a little earlier, and it's his complaint about how people in his day are so distracted that they don't even stop to ask the big questions. So let's just plunge into this.
If our condition were truly happy, we should not need to divert ourselves from it. Being unable to cure death, wretchedness, and ignorance, men have decided, in order to be happy, not to think about such things. I have often said that the sole cause of man's unhappiness is that he does not know how to stay quietly in his room. The only good thing for man, therefore, is to be diverted from thinking of what they are, either by some occupation which takes their mind off it, or by some novel and agreeable passion which keeps them busy, like gambling, hunting, some absorbing show, in short, by what is called diversion. That is why gaming and feminine society, war and high office are so popular. It is not that they really bring happiness, nor that anyone imagines that true bliss comes from possessing the money to be won and gaming or the head that is hunted. No one would take it as a gift. What people want is not the easy, peaceful life that allows us to think of our unhappy condition, not the dangers of war, not the burdens of office, but the agitation that takes our minds off it and diverts us. That is why we prefer the hunt to the capture.
Good. Very well read, brother. Thank you. What does it mean by this sentence, in your own words? I've often said that the sole cause of man's unhappiness is that he does not know how to stay quietly in his room. I think he'd be writing about our own day, right? Mm-hmm. But put this into your own words and maybe give me a couple of applications from your own experience.
That people find the opportunity to think and reflect about big questions disturbing and they would rather have their minds filled instead.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you an experience of it. I was a university evangelist. I did 65 university and college missions one after another, and then needed half an hour to lie down in a darkened room. And I have various memories that come back to me. And one was a student who came up to me in the morning, a couple of days into the mission. He said, I came to a couple of the events yesterday. He said, I haven't slept all night. Oh. He said, I've been thinking and thinking and thinking about these questions. And this was early on in the mission, so it wasn't gospel content. It was thinking about questions and challenging them to think about questions of meaning and purpose and things. He said, I've been thinking and thinking and thinking. And he said, I just can't cope with this. I'm not going to come back to anything. Wow. I'm just telling you, I don't want to be here.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just the challenge to... I'm an ex-psychologist, so it's the centre of what's sometimes called cognitive dissonance.
Yes, indeed.
Actually, he's got a worldview worked out. He's comfortable with it. Mm-hmm. That's okay. I just live that way. And then here's someone that's causing me to think about big questions. It's so disturbing. Mm. I don't want to do it. Mm. I'd rather go and do other things to distract me from it. Mm. And I think Pascal puts it very well, isn't it? That people don't want to sit and think about things because it's disturbing. I'd rather just take my mind taken off.
Be active, and what a powerful example. Yeah, and I think today, well, name some of the ways in which we distract ourselves that even Pascal probably couldn't have dreamed of. I mean, he talks about gaming and chasing women. You know, what are some of the ways today that you see people not, you know, postponing the questions?
Philosophic discourse.
Okay. you can. Yeah, that's true. There, in certain circles, they just talk and talk and talk.
That's the way it is in France.
Yeah.
People talk and talk and talk.
Yeah. No, they talk about the big questions.
Yeah. Yeah, but in a way that it can skirt them. Yeah.
Nothing.
Okay. I was thinking of how we're all tethered to an electronic. Leash device thing, and I'm an older person who didn't grow up with all this, but I'm increasingly drawn to the need to answer my emails all the time or to text somebody who where I teach, this is a graduate school of theology where we're training ministers, and every now and then I'll sit in the back of the room just because we have a guest lecturer, and I watch what's on the screens. And it ain't the lecture. It is texting their friends, or one person I saw playing a solitaire game. And you know, there's just so many ways today, with a click of a button or the mouse, that you can distract yourself, and you don't ask the big questions. We're not going to read this, but Faust, the next text or the text before. The classic story of this doctor who wants to be powerful, and the devil, you know, tempts him and says, "I'll give you power and money and prowess, and only thing is, at the end of your life, you have to give me your soul." And at first, he realizes this is not a good bargain, but he just wants the power so much that he finally caves in. And Os Guinness calls this bargaining. And there's thousands of ways to bargain against the big questions by putting things off, using philosophy in the wrong way, but everything but staying quietly in his room.
But you can stay quietly in your room without hitting the big questions too,
Yeah, but you see what he's saying. If you're so distracted that you can't sit tight and meditate, you're probably in trouble spiritually.
I'm just reflecting on Pascal's piece on devotion. And I remember, I think it was in a lecture by Os Guinness once at the London Institute, talked about, you know, when we explore, for example, Francis Schaeffer's approach in terms of exploring the tensions between the world as it is out there and what we say about the world. I think Oz then talked about the spectrum, that there are two poles. One pole is the what he called the dilemma pole, and the other pole being the diversion pole.
No, right.
You know, we are pushed and drawn between those two poles. On the one side, you know, the more honest we are, the more we are moving towards the dilemma.
Right.
And then the whole Schaeffer's approach, of course, of uncovering that is extremely helpful. And then we are here on the other side, the diversion pole, where, you know, people don't want to face the dilemma. And then, of course, that's where we want to sit, maybe alone in our room and use the social media.
You know, maybe it's because I feel like I'm getting older, but you think about these things increasingly with age because you're closer to the threshold of the next life. And there are an amazing number of people my age who find ways to avoid thinking about that. And yet it's painfully obvious, you know. You can't move as fast. You can't, you know, do what you used to do. And doesn't that send a message? But we insistently kind of find ways to, pretend that it's not going to happen.
Wasn't this also, you know, one of the issues in, you know, in the Marigold Hotel? About the group of British retired people going to India.
Yeah. Best Exotic Marigold Hotel.
Film
is coming to the States.
How to, how life is then viewed in such a context where you're sort of in a way escaping from your old context, but still ending up somewhat in the same context because you can't sort of escape yourself.
That's a great lesson.
Those kinds of issues. Very telling.
When we first started out, we lived in a little house next to a bigger house where our landlord lived. And he was a nice enough fellow. He's about 80, 81. And once I went over there to give him something, and there was a young woman with him, and he said, "This is my niece." And I said, "Okay, fine, good." And then he took me aside and said, "I don't want you to tell anybody what's obviously going on here." And he told me he had turned 80 and he wanted to start a new lease in life, and he'd gotten some money and he was going to travel around the world with this girl and everything. Next week he got a massive stroke and he was in hospital, and Barbara and I went to see him, and he was absolutely furious at God. I don't know if we believed in God or not, but he said, "I finally got to the place where I can have some fun, you know, and why does he cut me off like this, you know?" And I was a young man and starting out, and I was quite astonished that you could be so rebellious so at such an age, instead of saying, you know, "I'm near the end, maybe I need some help," you know. As far as I know, he died completely bitter, you know, it's scary. So he talks about the obvious, about diversions. Let's read a little further. Who wants to do the next paragraph? "That is all that men have been able to devise." Would you feel comfortable reading it? Thanks.
"That is all that men have been able to devise for attaining happiness. Basic philosophize about it, holding that people are quite unreasonable to spend all day chasing a pair that they would not have wanted to buy, having little knowledge of our nature. The hair itself would not save us from thinking about death and the miseries distracting us, but hunting it does so. Thus when Phyrus was advised to take the rest towards which he was so strenuously striving, he found it very hard to do so. Telling a man to rest is the same as telling him to live happily. It means advising him to enjoy a completely happy state which he can contemplate at leisure without cause for distress."
What's it? Go ahead. Don't.
It means not understanding nature.
Yeah, good. Well, and then, "Thus men who are naturally conscious of what they are shun nothing so much as rest. They would do anything but to be disturbed." What's he saying here? It's not radically new, but he puts a different angle on it. What's this business about preferring to hunt than actually to get the hare? Yeah. I remember in the 60s already that people were talking about, you know, it's not the goal, but it's the journey that really matters. And even as a young kid, I thought to myself, that's really stupid, because you want a goal, you know. Journeys, I love journeys, but you have to get somewhere. But Pascal is saying that they don't want the goal. So the goal here, telling a man to rest, is the same thing as telling him to live happily. Can you unpack that for me? Yeah, it's the same thought as before, but why do they shun rest, which is the one thing we all need desperately?
And you're faced with the real question.
Mm-hmm.
You're faced with the issue of the life.
You're alone with yourself. There's a marvelous essay that's been around for a while now by Michael Novak. It's called something like Keeping the Big Questions at Bay or something like that. And it starts off with a friend of his, I think he's a real person, named Ed. And Ed had a two-part philosophy: always keep moving and never turn the volume down. And he describes this poor man who's wretchedly nervous, and he gets in his car and he drives and he turns on the, you know, the CD, and then he gets home and he can't be home quietly. He has to have entertainment all around him, and he's more and more fidgety, this person, and less fun to be with, because he can't just stop and have an honest conversation. He won't look at you in the eye. He darts around, you know, when you're talking to him. And it's kind of this scary parable of a person, I think, who's caught up in the matrix of our modern temptations. And his point is, he can't stop and ask big questions, which is the one thing he needs to do. Any other comments on this text?
I don't know the reference, because someone's only just told me this a little while ago. And I said, but apparently it's Pascal. You may know where it is in Pascal. But a linking between the two of this. Pascal said, there is enough light in the world for those who want to see, but enough darkness for those who choose to hide.
That is a great quote. Could have been Pascal.
And that is kind of... It links the two together, doesn't it? That, yes, you know, that there is light. We can be led, but as in Plato's cave, they don't want to be led out. And as in this passage, that actually, I'd rather stay in the darkness. And you can choose to do that, or you can... Actually, there is enough light to see.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds us of Jesus' day. I mean, he was the light of the world, and he came that the world may be enlightened, but instead some of the world rejected him and preferred the darkness to the light. Yeah. Oh, we have time for one more, maybe a couple. Let's look at Auden. This is yet another text in the Time for Questions, which is a fascinating text. I use this a lot in my own work. But you'll know, most of you, who W.H. Auden was. I actually had the privilege of meeting him. I was at university, I was in a literary society, and he came by, and you know, he was an old man now, but he was a delightful kind of a codger. He was one of the major poets of the 20th century. He began as a liberal humanist. In the 30s, he was a left-wing, left-leaning person. There were so many of those in Great Britain. And he later, of course, became disillusioned when he found out more about what was really happening under communism and that sort of thing. But his basic philosophy was that human beings were fundamentally good. However, they were sometimes limited in expressing their good by circumstance or money or bad upbringing or, you know, things like that. So get the barriers away and they'll fly as free people. He moved to the United States with a friend and actually lived in the German part of New York, of Manhattan, known as Yorkville, and not only was the language, the common language on the street, German, but the grocery stores, the schools, and even the movies were in German. And he went to the cinema one night with a friend, and they saw a movie clip before the main feature called Sieg im Poland, which was an account of Hitler's invasion of Warsaw, and, you know, a dreadful experience. Now, I'm not going to tell you what happened because he's going to say it himself, but it turned him from a near atheist, certainly an agnostic, left-leaning person, to a seeker, and then he shortly thereafter re-entered the Church of England, which was his background, and believed the God of the Bible. Let's see. Who would like to read the first paragraph? I can read the second one. Are you ready to read the first one?
Yes.
Yeah, thanks.
We are now
2 months after the outbreak of the war.
Yes, okay. The fatal flaw.
Yeah.
2 months after the outbreak of war in November 1939, he went to a cinema in Yorkville, the district of Manhattan, where he and Isherwood had lived for a few weeks in the spring. It was largely a German-speaking area, and the film he saw was Sieg im Poland, an account by the Nazis of their conquest in Poland. When Poles appeared on the screen, it was startled to hear a number of people in the audience scream, "Kill them!" He later said of this, "I wonder then why I reacted as I did against this denial of every humanistic value. The answer brought me back to the church."
He'd been through many changes of heart since reaching adulthood, but all the dogmas he had adopted or played with, post-Freudian psychology, Marxism, and the liberal socialist democrat outlook that had been his final political stance before leaving England, had one thing in common. They were all based on a belief in the natural goodness of man. They all claimed that if one specific evil were removed, be it sexual repression, the domination of the proletariat by the bourgeoisie, or fascism, then humanity would be happy and the unrest would cease. Even the viewpoint which Auden had reached in the summer of 1939 during his honeymoon, a viewpoint expressed in The Prolific and the Devourer, which might be called liberal humanism with religious and pacifist overtones, was still based on a belief in man's natural goodness. Its message was, in the words of the poem which summed it up, "We must love one another or die." That is, only the exercise of love between human beings would save humanity from self-destruction. The implication was that if humanity followed this precept and also obeyed a divine law, it could save itself, being fundamentally good. Auden's experience in the Yorkville cinema in November 39 radically shook this belief. He now became convinced that human nature was not and never could be good. The behavior of those members of the audience who shouted, "Kill them!" was indeed, as he said, a denial of every humanistic value. Okay, it's obvious at one level, but I think it's quite powerful. Where was he? Why was he shocked? And what effect did it have on him?
He seemed to have a very positive, you know, one-sided view of humanity.
Yeah.
That humanity is really only good. And so the fact that someone so strongly responded by instinct, as it were, to, you know, to the screen, was probably very disturbing.
Yeah. No, absolutely, that's well put.
It's a classic song, 71 by John Lennon. Imagine, you know, heaven, blah, 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 blah. And the world below, it's all predicated upon the same belief.
If we could take away these barriers, our goodness would shine. Yeah. And love not only will be, but can be practiced to the place where it could save humanity. But why should such an outcry, "Kill them, kill the Poles," provoke a sense that man mankind is not good. I mean, why didn't he say, for example, some Germans are not good? Which he didn't say. Mm-hmm. But he didn't just say immigrant Germans are bad. He said, he came to the conclusion that everybody, including himself, was bad. Why didn't he just say, well, this is some nutcase who doesn't know how to behave in a movie?
That's what we'd say today.
I think so. In a postmodern world, yeah, we'd say that's his framework.
I'm not familiar with the story, so I don't know. But, I mean, could it be partly that actually he recognized in them his own tendency, to do, his own potential to do that? That I think of them... we had a big tragedy in Britain 10, 15 years ago, probably, with Jamie Bulger murders. Mm-hmm. Little boy Jamie Bulger was murdered by 2 8- or 9-year-old kids. And on the day when they arrested the kids, the front page of all the newspapers, every single newspaper, had the two pictures of these two kids. And one of the reactions that you heard time and time again was, they just look like we did at that age. Well, they just look so normal.
Yeah.
They look like our kids.
Yeah.
You know, you expect the kids who murdered this young boy, Jamie Bulger, to be monsters. But they weren't. They were like normal kids. And I was doing a mission in Exeter University at the time, I remember, and I just hooked onto that so much that actually, you know, we all have this capacity to do these terrible
things.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Is that what
I think? I believe that's exactly what happened. It's Hannah Arendt, you know, the banality of evil. We're all capable. The parallel that comes to my mind is Solzhenitsyn, who in the Gulag had come to, you know, love this Dr. Kornfeld that visited him, the Christian, Jewish Christian man. And when he was murdered, Solzhenitsyn began to think, it would be nice if evil was bad people outside of us. We just get rid of them. Instead, he came to the conclusion evil it comes right down the human breast and it divides us in two. We have capability for good, but we have, each of us has capability for evil. And if you erase that, you erase us. And I think Auden in some way, because Solzhenitsyn had begun to reflect on his own past, his own nature. He realized he had been abusive to women. He had manipulated his way up politically. You know, he was a Stalinist. And it dawned on him that this is not their problem, but it's our problem. These are human beings crying, kill the Poles. And he's a human being. This actually comes clearer in the next part. Would you kindly read that for us, the next couple of paragraphs, Nick?
In the weeks that followed this experience, he considered its implications. It was not just a question of shattered optimism. The whole ground of his outlook had shifted beneath his feet. If humanity were not innately good, then on what basis could he legitimately object to the murderous shouts of the Germans in that cinema audience, or indeed to the behavior of Hitler himself?
Mm.
Were not the Nazis merely being true to their own nature, to all our natures? What reason could he give for his strong, instinctive, ineradicable hatred of the Nazis and all they stood for? He had to find some new objective ground from which to argue against Hitler. There had, as he put it, to be some reason why Hitler was utterly wrong.
And so here's his journey from the shock of hearing somebody, presumably a normal human being, crying with such hatred, to the place where he has to explain his own hatred of the Nazi mentality, that it would be so powerful as to provoke such a ridiculous outcry. And so he's moving. Explain that move. It, of course, it doesn't happen to everybody, but do you know any other examples of that, or has it happened to anyone around you that has been jolted by the presence of evil in a way that has made them not necessarily skeptical, but look for a reason why you should call anything wrong?
Well, that happened in 9/11 when the planes were hitting in. I think I mean, for those Christians who were thinking about the problem of evil and find, you know, the solution in Christ, it wasn't quite such a shock. But I think for some people, you know, who were very humanistically, their reactions were more humanistic, you know, they just were appalled.
Yeah, some of you, maybe all, are familiar with what's happening in Norway here. Mm-hmm. And now the trial is going on, you know, for weeks and weeks and weeks, and it's very, you know, a lot of powerful stories. But I think, you know, what happened also at the very beginning, when instinctively people thought this must have been a jihad terrorist, and then realized no, it was a Norwegian, you know, someone what seemed to be a normal person. I mean, obviously was not a normal person by any category, morally speaking.
Yeah.
But normally, ethnically.
Yeah.
And I think that jolted people, really. So people have said, what would have happened if this would have been someone from same background, and now there are so many discussions. How should we interpret this? How should we understand this? How should we react to this? Is evil a reality? I mean, there's quite a lot of quite powerful.
Is it so? Good opportunities, Lars?
Yeah. I think so. And people are seriously asking. There was the National Day of Norway just 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
People said previously we had, you know, we talked about the importance of freedom of speech, of human dignity, but now it makes sense in a different way.
Yeah.
Because there are some values that need to be protected.
Oh.
So I think there's a great opportunity, but many people, of course, do not go the road that Auden did here.
Yeah.
They stop sort of along that road.
Yeah.
So I was actually thinking about the possibility of using this story. You know.
Yeah.
It's a very powerful story.
Didn't that young man claim to be a Christian?
Well, you see, on his Facebook, he had written, you know, under categories, he had written religion, Christian, political, conservative. People said, this is a conservative Christian.
Oh, damn.
Because that's
so
the
that
media.
Yeah,
that
was
well,
the media. All the media were just looking for a hook. Because initially it was, he's a Muslim fundamentalist.
Yeah.
And then, oh no, he's a Christian fundamentalist.
But it's quite clear that he's a non-religious person in the traditional sense of the word.
Yeah.
So he wasn't raised in a...
No, not at all. And he had no kind of church links or whatever, but he was thinking completely culturally, you know, in terms of Western Europe being a Christian setting. So what should he describe himself? He was not an atheist, he thought, so he had to write Christian.
Yeah, he's a cultural Christian, and that was part of his argument as well, about the Islamification of Scandinavia.
Yeah.
Lars, can I ask you, sorry, I don't want to distract from
this. This is good. This is very good.
In the reaction in Norway, has there been any kind of consideration of the fact that one of the things, apart from the many things that the Andreas Breivik situation tells us, but one of them, I think, is the danger of a utilitarian ethic.
Mm-hmm.
Because our culture, as our culture has turned its back on God, we have no sense of, well, God tells us right and wrong. So a prevailing ethic is a utilitarian ethic. Mm-hmm. Of the right thing to do is that which will give the greatest happiness to the greatest number. And that is precisely the argument that he is expressing in the court.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, it was a terrible thing I had to do, but I knew I had to do it for the greater good of Norway and Scandinavia. You know, I didn't want to kill these kids, but if I didn't do that, then it would be terrible for everyone. And he's very clear, although he doesn't use the word utilitarianism, he's very clearly advocating a utilitarian ethic. And I wonder if that's been picked up and explored.
Not really,
I'm
afraid. Not really in the public debate.
Yeah.
Because it should certainly be raised.
Yeah.
Yeah. It should.
Because that's the...
Yeah, but that's true in the Western world now. I mean, we now have a president in France who's not married. You know, the president of the United States has come out for same-sex marriage. You know, it's all utilitarian. You know, justice, fairness, for equality for everybody. There's no higher standard.
Mm-hmm. Are they saying, is the defense saying that he's just deranged?
No. He has a very strong stand himself that he's not.
Yeah. He wanted to do this, right?
Yeah. And you may have heard that there were two reports from psychiatrists, the first report said he is deranged, the second report he's not. So everyone is now following, wondering what will be the result of you know, the verdict. And I think some, quite a few people were disturbed about the first report because they felt it was morally wrong not to hold him accountable. I mean, one thing is psychiatric or psychological categories. Another thing is moral guilt. So there may be a relationship, but not separating them completely, as it were. So I think there was actually a moral outrage, I think, in people in general saying, well, this man has to be convicted. You know, in a way. There has to be some kind of justice.
Otherwise there's no justice,
It wasn't the Second World War an example of this phenomenon? Nazism, but we discovered it did to a certain race of people, etc., etc., and our outrage at that. How could it be? How could this the liberal establishment having to come to grips with that?
That's right. And as I said about Auden, he was a part of a left-wing fellowship that was disillusioned. Russ, we're going to talk about Russell in a little bit, and he was similarly disillusioned. André Gide, many others, when they actually traveled to the Soviet Union, they saw this is not what we were told, you know. So, but they had the fortitude to recognize that they had been misled morally and not just, you know, by some sort of subterfuge. The same with, you were mentioning 9/11. After our famous, awful, horrible bombing of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the Harvard Crimson, which is a newspaper that we used to read as students, it had a very famous debate. Student writers said, this is evil. Several of the professors said, you haven't been listening to us. You know, those categories are outdated, you know. Students were right. You know, I mean, this is, how could you describe this in any other terms, you know? Okay, let's finish this up because you'll see how he moves pretty fast. This is his biographer, by the way. This is not him speaking directly. Go ahead, Jim.
This line from the Brothers Karamazov.
Yeah.
From Dostoevsky, God does not exist and everything
is absolutely.
Appropriate to this.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jim, would you like to read from Auden began to remark to his friends right to the end of this?
Okay. Auden began to remark to his friends on this desperate need for objective criteria from which to oppose Hitler. The English intellectuals who now cry to heaven against the evil incarnated in Hitler have no heaven to cry to, he told Eric and Mann's brother, Golo. They have nothing to offer, and their prospects echo in empty space. It seemed utterly clear to him now that liberalism had a fatal flaw in it. The whole trend of liberal thought, he wrote in 1940, has been to undermine faith in the absolute. It has tried to make reason the judge. But since life is a changing process, the attempt to find a humanistic basis for keeping a promise works logically within the conclusion, I can break it whenever I feel it convenient. He was now certain that he must renew that faith in the absolute, which appeared to him to be the only possible ground for moral judgment. As he put it in a poem written a short time after visiting the Yorkville cinema, either we serve the unconditional, or some Hitlerian monster will supply an iron convention to do evil by. So it was that he now began to search for, in the words of this same poem, the vision that objectifies. He began to read some books of theology.
This is quite extraordinary. So again, this is not everybody's experience, but his path was a direct path from being jolted and shocked by an outcry to feeling himself utter revolt at the evil before him, to looking for a reason why it was okay to feel revolt. Any comments on that? What about the emptiness of liberalism, and what are some parallels today, maybe? Is he over the top when he says a Hitlerian monster will supply an iron convention to do evil by? Or is this, in fact, well, what Jim was saying from Dostoevsky? in Peter Berger's work, I'm not sure we're going to read that here, but it's in this series. He talks about indices of transcendence, not proofs, of course, in the sense of classical proofs, but what Schaeffer used
signals.
To... Yeah, signals, exactly. Signals of transcendence, yeah. And Schaeffer used to call things like the mannishness of man or moral motions. One of them is condemnation. How can you condemn something if there isn't an absolute somewhere? And everybody that I've met, no matter how relativist and how, you know, they're far away from any idea of an absolute morality, has some place where their outrage protests too much. Can you think of any parallels here to this in your experience? Or
I know plenty who don't get it, and that's the that's the new atheists who will talk about, you know, Richard Dawkins talks about evil and the evil of religion, but he won't recognize that actually his perspective shows that there, you know, from his naturalistic perspective, there is no basis to make evil a reasonable concept to apply.
And same with Daniel Dennett.
Yeah, it is. And the thing is, Peter S. Williams, not Peter J. Williams, Peter S. Williams, who's our philosopher in residence at Damaris, he's got a book coming out very soon, C.S. Lewis and the New Atheists. What would C.S. Lewis say to the New Atheists today? And one of the things, because Pete's been doing a lot of research on this, and he says, in all the debates that there are with the new atheists, the people who are debating with them say to them, look, if there is no God, there is no objective basis for morality. Right? And they unpick that, and they unpack that, and they explain it. So there's no reason whatsoever for these new atheists to not get it. So it's a double negative. They must get it. Mm-hmm. They must understand that, from their perspective, as metaphysical naturalists, there is no basis for morality. But they always, without exception, sidestep it with a quip of saying, oh, you're saying if I'm not religious, I can't be moral. Mm-hmm. Of course I can be moral. And it's a sidestep. It's not the issue. It's a smokescreen. And Pete is convinced that this is a deliberate act on their part to obfuscate, to say, we're not going to address that question. Because if we once admitted that, that the rug's pulled out from underneath us.
Indeed.
And we don't want to admit that publicly.
Yeah, indeed.
Which is, you know, fascinating if that is the case. So they don't, you know, they don't get it. I mean, I think they do get it, personally, but they are refusing to see it.
In a postmodern world, you don't have to be consistent, do you?
No, you don't, but they would want consistency.
Yeah, Dawkins is not postmodern. Yeah, he's modern.
Yeah, he is. He would want consistency.
Yeah.
But he doesn't want to admit on that point. And I think it's fascinating to see, you know, Pete's argument that they do understand but they're deliberately sidestepping it every time.
Romans 1, all over again. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
They know the truth.
And so again, it's not moving towards the dilemma, but towards the diversion.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and not coming out into the light, but staying in the cave.
Yeah, that thing is, Schaeffer used to say virtually the same thing. There were two poles. One, the pole of the real world, and the other, the pole of a person's philosophy. And some people, you know, are more consistent with their philosophy, and we don't like them very much because they seem so far from reality. Some people are closer to reality, even though they're not Christians, and we like them because they're closer to reality. I mean, he used Camus and Sartre, and he says what you've got to do is gently but firmly push the inconsistent person, whom we like, more towards what it should be if you really believed what you say you believe, and what you would do if you really believed that. Yeah. Go ahead, please.
Coming back to the Auden one,
yeah.
I noticed that he uses the term absolute, faith in the absolute.
Yes, he does.
And I'm wondering, when you've done this with non-Christians on this, whether they balk at it up, because I find they balk at the word absolute, but understand the word objective. And there is a difference between that. That actually, you know, that philosophically one can see that if relativism is wrong, there is an objective reality. and they can see objective morality, so objective basis for morality, which people can accept and think about. But as soon as anyone uses the word absolute morality, that immediately sounds judgmental, mm-hmm. and it sounds as if the basis for morality has now become in me and what I'm saying. So it sounds dogmatic. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I always never use the word absolute.
Yeah.
I won't talk about absolute morality. I'll talk about objective morality.
Yeah.
Because the word absolute is... But I wondered, in here, and when you're doing the Trinity Forum, see, if I was using this with a bunch of non-Christians, I would feel really uncomfortable yeah. about this because it's got the word absolute yeah. there, and I know it's going to play to all their negative, you know...
Because this was at least a generation or two before... so much knowledge was translated into power.
Yeah.
And so the word absolute brought with it not quite as much of a opprobrium as it does today when people are feeling oppressed by claims like that. There's a question of wisdom. What's the best word? Because you don't want to offend them without being... without necessity. But the other is, at some point, they're going to have to come up to admit that there is an authority up there. And
yeah.
What's the best word to get to them? I don't know, but it's going to look like an absolute. So,
but it's God's absolute, it's not our absolute.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, I tell this story often. We were at a meeting of InterVarsity, which is UCCF in America, where Dick Kies, a friend of many of ours, was speaking at a women's college, a very high-powered women's college near where we live. And he gave a talk on something like, do you need God for morality? And it was a brilliant talk. But the question and answer period was fascinating. One young woman asked him the following line of questions. She said, sir, you believe in truth, do you not? And Dick said, yes, I do. So you'll be wanting to coerce me? And Dick said, absolutely not. I couldn't do that, and I wouldn't want to. But you believe in truth. Yeah, I do. So anybody who believes in truth has to want to force the other person into his position. And Dick said no. And it went, she just couldn't see it. And yeah. finally he said, I don't want to coerce you. I couldn't, and my Lord forbids it. But I would like to persuade you. She didn't see the difference.
Really?
Yeah. Because there's a world of difference between yeah. coercion and pervasion. So it's like you're... People yeah. who are sensitive to word absolute, they feel they're being coerced.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
Another issue at stake here is not just the objective or absolute, but the issue of the motivation for humans to be moral, to continue to sustain that motivation to live morally in this world. There is no God. Second possible meaning for Dostoevsky's quote. It's not just the issue of is there a God or is there not, he's the objective or absolute standard for morality. But the other issue, if you take him away, you lose their motivation to be moral, to live morally, if he's not there.
Yeah.
That's another thing we could use in terms of discussion or conversation.
You know, there's a whole, you probably know this, there's a whole Trinity Forum curriculum called When No One Sees.
Yeah.
You know, if you could be sure no one was looking, even God, would you, you know, go this way?
Sometimes I find that people who don't go to church and, you know, think about God and read the Bible, when moralism is their ultimate,
yeah.
that they seem, they can be very disciplined and very moral.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
In a way that makes some Christians, you know, myself included, you know, look,
I mean, there are good people, of course, but, you know, if they were persuaded nobody could see, would they continue to be good? Probably some would, but I bet a lot of them would say, oh, okay, it's like that, is it?
Unless moralism is your God, is your ultimate, is your, for granted,
I mean,
no reason, but...
The Pharisees were these highly moralistic people, but our Lord pointed out lots of instances where they allowed themselves to transgress joyfully because they thought they had the rules right over here. So I can, you know, they disregarded their mother in the name of the law of Korban, you know, which is a sacrifice of, so because make the temple a richer place. I don't have to worry about my mom. So I think most moralistic people have some fatal flaw in there somewhere. They kind of have to.
It's interesting how people often misunderstand also apologetics, in relation to this. People think that we are trying to to manipulate or try
That's
to
right.
force people
yeah.
or coerce them. We just had Bill Craig visiting us in Norway, a wonderful visit. And there are two Christian daily newspapers, one based in Oslo, the capital, one based on the west coast in Bergen. And they both wrote about this. And the actual reports were quite good. But then the headlines, you know, on the first page weren't that good. I mean, the one on the west coast, the Bergen, wrote, "The atheist crusher comes to Norway."
That's just the way he wants to be known, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that wasn't the most appropriate thing I've read. And then, the Oslo one wrote, "God can be proved."
Oh, yeah.
I mean, so it's, you know, into two different.
Yeah, interesting.
Two different.
Yeah.
Perversions of what
yeah.
has happened.
Yeah.
So actually, I wrote a piece then a couple of weeks ago. On a debate site, which is highly respected, saying crushing, proving, or justifying.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And I just checked today, it was, you know, about 3,000 visits.
Ooh.
And 100 comments, and people are, you know.
Wow, great.
So it's that's one way of, you know, entering public
debate. Yeah, yeah.
It's actually operated by something called the free word. Free public speech, and the Oslo paper, newspaper. So,
how nice to have that vehicle.
So anyone can enter any kind of article, you know, or blog or whatever you call it.
Mm-hmm.
And people can join in. Mm-hmm. There are some atheists who actually loves to crush others. You know, but
so
case, they actually illustrate, you know, by coming in and trying to destroy. And some it's moderating itself.
Yeah.
So.
Good. Great opportunity.
I wonder the extent to which, I never start a sentence when you're not quite sure where you're going. So I wonder what the extent to which the atheist concern about justifying an argument. Comes from a kind of a subconscious understanding of the Oxford academic who talks about relativism. You cannot be a consistent moral relativist because arguing a case actually implies an objective morality, because you're saying, so if you take the basic, you know, premise, conclusion, syllogistic logic of Aristotle, if, you know, Socrates is a man, all men die, therefore Socrates will die, there is a you ought to accept that conclusion.
Yeah.
You have to accept that conclusion, and it is a moral ought to accept it.
It's not just a
mathematical formula. And so the argument is that you know, if there is no if you're going to advance an argument for relativism, you actually have to presuppose objectivism in order to advance argument.
Yeah.
And I wonder if part of it is that kind of understanding. If they have that in their minds, even if it's not consciously worked out, they think, even if you say that you are arguing rationally, logically, maybe me, even if you say that you're justifying, I know you must be trying to manipulate me, because I don't actually believe in logical argument.
Yeah.
I can't believe in logical argument because it relies on an objective moral ought, and I ought to accept a conclusion. So actually, it's just a will to power. It's just your...
Yeah, that's like this young woman. Persuasion, coercion, same thing.
Yeah. And perhaps that's what's going on psychologically.
I think so.
Actually,
I think so. And they don't see the logical fallacy of... If everything is relative, then I'm an absolutist, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they don't see that.
Yeah.
So, just briefly, the first portion of this is entitled A Time for Questions. And then the second is entitled A Time for Answers. And as I mentioned earlier, three families of answers are given in this portion by three... by different adherents to the three views. And they are all centered on the problem of evil. So the problem of evil is presented, and then series of Asian answers suggesting that evil is an illusion are given, and then a series of more Stoic answers, including Albert Camus, are given. And if I'm happy to, you know, divert this or to go into different texts that we haven't looked at, and Camus is one of my heroes, and then a series of Christian answers. The point of this is to shop, in a way, if you will, and to look for what each family is trying to present. For the Stoic answer, it would be hard to beat Bertrand Russell, who's one of the great preachers of his generation. I remember him very well. I was not that young when he died, and he was first of all the founder, maybe co-founder, of one of the most important branches of philosophy with Alfred North Whitehead. Second of all, he, because of his pacifist views, he was condemned to spend a lot of time in jail. In those days, pacifism wasn't an option, and you certainly didn't qualify for civil service the way you do, you know, now. But it was a crime, and he wrote enormously on issues of war and peace. But he also wrote about morality, family life, things like that. And he was one of these left-leaning Brits who, to his credit, he was actually one of the first to be disillusioned with the Soviet experiment. André Gide, same thing. They traveled there and they saw what it was. And he was kicked out of his teaching position at Cambridge for his anti-war views. But when the Nazis came and Second World War developed, he began to change his mind about pure pacifism. He didn't quite go to the just war theory, but he had views that were close enough to, there are certain enemies, certain aggressors, that there's no other way to handle them but through force. And so he was restored to his chair at Cambridge. For most of his adult life, he was a very, very fierce atheist. In fact, I make our students read a collection of essays, all of which are defending atheism, which are, he leaves little doubt in your mind why I am not a Christian, okay? It's not, you can't just say, oh, you know, he was kind of on his way. He wasn't. But he's a very clear writer. And this particular essay is I think, one of the most fascinating pieces in his arsenal against the Christian faith. So if you don't mind, why don't I just read this through? It's not as long as it looks. It kind of coheres and holds together. So you need to hear the whole thing. When you hear it, be looking for certain terms and expressions, words that jump out at you. Be looking for what is his underlying philosophy, and then if you walked into the room, what would you want to say to him as a Christian? Amid such a world, if anywhere, our ideals henceforward must find a home. That man is the product of causes which had no provision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforward be safely built. United with his fellow men by the strongest of all ties, the tie of a common doom, the free man finds that a new vision is with him always, shedding over every daily task the light of love. The life of man is long, a long march through the night, surrounded by invisible foes, tortured by weariness and pain, toward a goal that few can hope to reach, and where none may tarry long. One by one, as they march, our comrades vanish from our sight, seized by the silent orders of omnipotent death. Very brief is the time in which we can help them, in which their happiness or misery is decided. Be it ours to shed sunshine on their path, to lighten their sorrows by the balm of sympathy, to give them the pure joy of never-tiring affection, to strengthen failing courage, to instill faith in hours of despair. Let us not weigh in grudging scales their merits and demerits, but let us think only of their need, of the sorrows, the difficulties, perhaps the blindnesses that make the misery of their lives. Let us remember that they are fellow sufferers in the same darkness, actors in the same tragedy with ourselves. And so, when their day is over, when their good and their evil have become eternal by the immortality of the past, be it ours to feel that where they suffered, where they failed, no deed of ours was the cause. But wherever a spark of the divine fire kindled in their hearts, we were ready with encouragement, with sympathy, with brave words in which high courage glowed. Brief and powerless is man's life. On him and all his race, the slow, sure doom falls pitiless and dark. Blind to good and evil, reckless of destruction, omnipotent matter rolls on its relentless way. For man, condemned today to lose its his dearest, tomorrow himself to pass through the gate of darkness, it remains only to cherish, ere yet the blow fall, the lofty thoughts that ennoble his little day. Disdaining the coward terrors of the slave of fate, to worship at the shrines that his own hands have built, dismayed by the empire of chance, to preserve a mind free from the wanton tyranny that rules his outward life, proudly defiant of the irresistible forces that tolerate for a moment his knowledge and his condemnation, to sustain alone a weary but unyielding atlas, the world that his own ideals have fashioned despite the trampling march of unconscious power. Okay, first of all, what kind of text is this? What is, how would you describe the genre, if there is one?
That's a good question.
I mean, is it an essay? Is it? Is it pure prose or elevated prose?
Elevated prose, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There is something, you know, you feel there is a real passion here.
Yes.
And at the same time, it's a you know, forceful, argumentative,
mm-hmm.
but it's not cold arguments. It's very involving.
Didn't this Why I'm Not a Christian begin as radio broadcast?
I did.
It broadcast
it did.
BBC.
So that's a clue.
So it's kind of a script. For
good.
A,
yeah.
Like a sermon.
I think it is. It is a sermon.
Sermon to the masses. Yes.
I think it's a sermon. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the. It's got the tone of a of some of the sermons we sometimes hear. You know. One by one. As they march, our comrades vanish from our sight. I mean, this is a... Okay, what are some of the expressions that that jump out at you? I mean, what... Just a couple of phrases or images that kind of struck you without going into the analysis quite yet.
The march, the second, you know, the second paragraph.
Yeah.
second sentence, the life of man is a long march through the night.
Has a sense of death march, doesn't it? Think of Pol Pot or something.
He might not be a Christian, but he uses kind of Christian language.
Okay, give me some examples of expressions that leap out at you.
Well, I just saw in that second paragraph, divine fire, good and evil, shrine, you know, one thing was about a shrine. And then something about going into eternity, immortality. I don't know. It seems paradoxical to use that language given his presupposition.
I like accidental collocations of atoms.
Yeah.
It's about as stark as you can get.
There is something here, isn't it? Maybe I'm moving on, but
that's fine.
The conflict, the very stark conflict between the atheist, the whole secular, naturalistic description of reality, and on the other hand, that humanity doesn't quite fit with that. It's a sort of a glimpses of something that is different with humans than with the rest, but not giving, reasons for why. But the whole time, why should we, try to, what was it? Helping others.
Yeah.
Something.
That's right.
Where is that again?
Well, he in the second full paragraph he says.
Their sorrow.
Yeah.
Give them poor joy.
Right, and don't weigh in grudging scary.
What is the motivation for that?
Yeah.
I don't see the motivation.
No, it's not there.
I see almost like an instinct, maybe not the right word, but an impulse at least. Something that comes out very deep from within, a wish to help others.
It is utterly astonishing, isn't it? Because on the one hand, he has this dark thing of accidental collocations of atoms, and it's going nowhere. On the other hand, let's be there for one another. Let's help them. And it's deceptive because it says room F, but it actually means the next room. I mean, and he goes very far with this, doesn't he? Be it ours to feel that where they suffered, where they failed, no deed of ours was the cause. That could have been written in Galatians, Okay, I think you've pointed out one of the major, major contrasts, which shows forth something about his philosophy and the flaws of it. Are there other examples of such a contrast in this text?
It's the it talks of the unyielding despair in the first paragraph, and then the second paragraph largely says the long march through to the night toward a goal that few can hope to reach, and where none may tarry long. That there is no purpose, there is no meaning to life. There's nothing that's going to make it any give it any value. And then in the last paragraph, it remains only to cherish the lofty thoughts that ennoble his little day. To worship at the shrines that his own hands have built. So is that that kind of David Hume's version of skepticism, isn't it? Mitigated skepticism. What's Hume's version of skepticism? Saying we live as if there's meaning.
Yeah.
As if we have
answers. Absolutely. Yeah.
That there are none, but we actually have to live as if there are. And he is displaying that, but in an impassioned sort of, but it's okay, it's good to do this, instead of saying, well, it's just, we either give up altogether, or else we
you know, I'll give up altogether, or else we live as if there's a meaning. But yeah. Actually, no, we're going to be more than that.
So, I mean, Berger would call this a signal of transcendence, wouldn't he? That he's got to have, no matter how petty and little the day is, some lofty thoughts, and yeah. They're ennobling.
Yeah.
You know, you have to, where does this come from? You know, if in your universe, how on earth can anything be noble?
Yeah.
And Barbara pointed out the Christian language. I mean, if there's nothing, no meaning, no nothing, what's this divine fire doing there? And why are there temples? And
but the temples are what we've made, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Is he, I mean, he was a brilliant man. He surely must have realized these contradictions. What is his philosophy? Can you put a label on it, or can you compare it to something that would allow a man who's so brilliant to make such obviously blatant contradictions?
Well, we have down here on the sidebar, down here, mm-hmm. It says that he wrote later, I wrote with passion and force because I really thought I had the gospel, so maybe that was his version of gospel.
Yeah.
And now I'm cynical about the gospel because it won't stand the test of life. Mm-hmm. So maybe this didn't hold out for him, eventually.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I don't know the chronology. But.
Well, it says some years later, but we... why is this included in the family of answers that is neither Asian nor Christian, but rather more stoical?
Secular humanism?
Okay, maybe. Although he's not, well, yeah, it's possible. A real humanist would at least, I think, celebrate the fact that you can make certain accomplishments. I think of Soft, he was a humanist. And he believed that there was things you could actually accomplish in the name of justice, even though no God. But this thing is so bleak.
Yeah, I'm not sure I see his... He wouldn't see it as bleak.
Okay, all right.
I don't think he's seeing it as bleak.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of, you know, Nietzsche's... the difference between... what is it? Active nihilism, passive nihilism,
oh, yeah.
And incomplete nihilism.
Yeah.
You know, so that incomplete nihilism is people who don't realize that because God doesn't exist, there is no meaning. Passive nihilism is those people who realize because God doesn't exist, there is no meaning, and they feel like giving up.
Mm-hmm.
But active nihilism is people who recognize there is no God, therefore life has no meaning. But I'm going to embrace it. I'm going to embrace life, and I'm going to embrace that meaninglessness.
Yeah.
And I'm going to exercise my will to power over the world,
mm-hmm.
and so on and so forth. You know, this to me sounds like it's Nietzsche's active nihilism.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it, you know, even though life is meaningless.
Camus is a little bit like this. He's more of a hopeful figure, but, you know, his enormous myth of Sisyphus. In the beginning, he says, the only philosophical question worth asking is whether or not life is worth the trouble of being lived. And then he goes on for hundreds of pages saying, there really isn't any reason, but it's worth it anyway. Mm-hmm. It's this kind of, okay, it's not worth, there's no good reason, but let's live.
It's worth writing a book.
Yeah, it's worth writing a book.
Getting still, he says, let's help people.
Does. He's there. Yeah, that's right. He's not completely negative. And he spent his whole life defending people. And he was passionate about peacemaking and things like that. Do you all have that quote from Blackham, who was the director of the Humanist Society? It's the larger of the... Yeah. Would you read that for us? Thanks.
The most drastic objection to humanism is that it is too bad to be true. The world is one vast tomb. If human lives are ephemeral, thank you. And human life itself doomed to ultimate extinction. There is no end to hiding from the ultimate end of life, which is death. But it does not avail. On humanist assumptions, life leads to nothing, and every pretense that this does not is a deceit. If there is a bridge over George which spans only half the distance and ends in mid-air, and if the bridge is crowded with human beings pressing on one after another, they fall into the abyss. The bridge leads nowhere, and those who are pressing forward to cross it are going nowhere. It does not matter where they think they are going, what preparation for the journey they may have made, how much they may be enjoying it all. The objection merely points out objectively that such a situation is a model of futility.
Thank you. Okay, what's he saying here? What's the... Is he with Russell in certain ways?
This seems to be, you know, very pessimistic.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Russell was ambivalent.
That's right. I think you're right.
You know, the picture of the bridge there.
Yeah, the bridge to nowhere.
It's very, very powerful.
Yeah.
You can almost see the people, you know, walking over the bridge and falling into the abyss. That's very strong.
I've heard American politicians criticize their opponents by saying that program is a bridge to nowhere. Some economic plan. You wonder, of course, why they bother to write, and that's the mystery here. Jean-Paul Sartre's thing in the next one, atheism is a cruel long-term business. I believe I've gone through it to the end. I don't think you have. But there is a... there's a will to live here that just doesn't seem to be defeatable.
Are they stronger than the will to power, maybe?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And even the will to do good. You know, Camus, the pest, the plague, there's this atheist doctor who does a lot of good to the community. And when the young man asks him, why you're an atheist, he says, it's because I'm an atheist, I'll fight the world, fight the creation. He actually uses that word. And he compares himself to the priest, Panelu, who says, who he caricatures as saying, you know, if God exists, I don't need to do anything. You know, I'll let him handle the plague. And Panelu never said that, but that's the way people thought of Christians. But I know many atheists who want to do good for reasons of anger. It's kind of strange.
Was Bertrand Russell earning money when he was... I mean, sometimes I wonder whether there's a commercial side.
Well, I don't know. I don't believe he was disingenuously earning money by beating up on the human race. There are people who do that, absolutely. You know, they're crazy artists who are doing ridiculous things and laughing all the way to the bank. But I don't honestly think Russell was... I think he really believed this stuff. And he was apparently, as a teenager, he was asking... He went to church, you know, and he asked people questions, and he said he never got anything like an intelligent answer. Don't know whether he did or not, but... Yeah. He was once asked by a Christian friend of his, what would you do if you died and went up to heaven and you saw God? And he said, I would tell him, not enough evidence.
Yeah.
which we know didn't happen. But you know, Francis Schaeffer and Cornelius Van Til and other influential apologists would call this defending the truth of Christianity by the impossibility of the contrary. You cannot successfully live in God's world as an atheist. There's going to be a leak somewhere. You know, there'll be something will pop its head up. You know, like a beach ball, you try to push it down in the ocean and it pops up. And I think for Russell and Soth himself and others, he had this deep need to help people and to love them and to cherish noble thoughts, and it just wouldn't go away because he's made after God's image. So, you know, in the questions, what sort of a person does this view appeal to? What would its impact be on different sectors of society, say on political leaders, business people, and young people? Do you know of people who would be drawn in by this view in those professions?
They're drawn in, I think, by his second half of, but we will ennoble our lives, mm-hmm. I think it's, but not the first half of the. I think I did a millennium debate in one of the big private schools in Britain. They wanted to do this big millennium debate. I debated with Peter Atkins, who's you know Richard Dawkins' kind of sidekick, and it was very interesting because I turned it away from. It was the question was, is God relevant to the third millennium? Mm-hmm. And I turned away from after a little while. Once got Peter Atkins going, stopped. Criticizing him and just getting him to speak and saying, so tell everyone from your perspective, you know, what's the purpose of life? Oh, there is no purpose to life, you know. And what's love? Well, love's a biological mechanism that gets two people together to pass on the genes. You know, all of this kind of, you know, this kind of thing, what's the end result of life? The end result of life is that we just die and disintegrate and that's all. And you could see the students there just going, no. I'm thinking, preach it, brother.
Yeah, I know.
I'm booking for all my evangelists. Because actually, they make something, well, no, it can't be.
He's saying
right. But for him, he had then still gone on to that second bit of here, saying, but still, I can still have an ennobled life.
Yeah.
And
For me, it's very different. What they're saying is something we've said they're saying on the printed page or in our voice. It's much more important to have them saying what they're saying exactly that way.
Yeah.
It's really, really important.
And,
you know, the stark contrast then between the naturalism of the view of reality and, you know, the instinctive feeling of value and of compassion that comes in and in the view of humanity. But which has no basis in the view of reality, and then that doesn't seem to bother, you know, people buy out of that in various ways, so they don't want to face that dilemma.
Right. Back to the bargaining a little bit. So then, in this section, there are all these answers that are given. That's just one. And then we do have some Christians speaking there. The third section is they call it a time for evidences, and by that is meant if you know you're asking questions about what I should believe. Well, who has the evidence? What's Russell's evidence for helping mankind, even though there seems to be no good reason for it? And so these texts are meant to confirm, or perhaps not to disconfirm what you might, choose, whether the answers we find so illuminating in the second stage are perhaps true. And if so, do certain problems that come up disqualify them? So, this is to verify or do due diligence. And I'll just pick a couple of examples here. And again, if you want to go over more of them, they're each fascinating. I've picked out two, one an Asian answer, and then the other something from our friend C.S. Lewis. So Robert Pirsig, in our generation, he was a cult figure. He wrote a remarkable book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And, you know, you weren't a bona fide member of the 60s if you didn't know this book pretty well by heart. But it's actually a fun read because he does dabble with Zen, and he goes east, and he studies in a Hindu university, and at this point, something happens that changes his life, and another one of these jolts. And this is short enough, I think we can probably read this. Jim, are you up or who's up? Okay, maybe just the first two paragraphs, and then we can pause, and then the last two we can read. In all the Oriental religions.
Where Hiroshima and Nagasaki illusory. In all of the Oriental religions, great value is placed on the Sanskrit doctrine of Tattvamasi, thou art that, which asserts that everything you think you are and everything you think you perceive are undivided. To realize fully this lack of division is to become enlightened. Logic presumes a separation of subject from object. Therefore, logic is not final wisdom. The illusion of separation of subject from object is best removed by the elimination of physical activity, mental activity, and emotional activity. There are many disciplines for this. One of the most important is the Sanskrit dhyana, mispronounced in Chinese as chan, and again mispronounced in Japanese as zen. Phaedrus never got involved in meditation because it made no sense to him. In his entire time in India, sense was always logical consistency, and he couldn't find any honest way to abandon this belief. That I think was credible on his part.
Great. Okay, there are so many varieties of Asian philosophies, and some of them wouldn't recognize each other in the other, but Zen, radical form of Zen Buddhism, it goes in and out of popularity, and here Robert Pirsig runs into one of the more radical forms. What is meant by thou art that? This might get a little philosophical here, but what's behind that statement?
Everything is one.
Yeah.
Monism.
Yeah, monism, good, right. To put it in Hindu terms, there are no divisions of significance. Everything is along a spectrum of the same thing. You could be closer to the center or further from the center. Now, why does he say to realize fully this lack of division is to become enlightened? And how different is that from the more Western way or the more logical way of thinking?
Well, to think critically means to see differences.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whereas this is, then the total opposite.
Right.
That to see less and less differences.
Right.
But actually, to understand that it's deeply one.
Yeah.
So it's very much anti. The critical thinking.
Right. Good. And as he says himself, there's no subject-object distinction. You know, we say, I am perceiving that blue wall. Zen says, no, you're not. You are the blue wall. And so for this reason, logic is not final wisdom. And he calls the separation of subject and object an illusion. But it's a very serious illusion, and many of us are trapped into it. How do we remove this illusion, according to Persig's understanding of Zen.
Stopping all activity, intellectual, emotional, physical activity, becoming one.
Yep.
The death of the I.
Yeah, exactly. The death of death of the self. Mm-hmm. They would call it the death of the self-centered self, but we would say it's the self.
Does it make for a more peaceful... in the West, are we a little too obsessed with all
I think that's the attraction of Zen to Westerners, is that it has an appeal of detachment and of blending in with the way reality is, rather than always being outside of it and dukes up and criticizing it. Ultimately, obviously, as you would know, is
Christianity grapples with something of the problem.
It does.
There's been a wrong focus on self.
Yeah.
It needs to be reoriented back to what God had originally intended.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, Francis Schaeffer talks about the essence of death being separation, right? Separation between us and God, us and fellow people, us and the environment, and us and ourselves. You know, he calls this schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. So there is a sense of separation being wrong. And this is trying to say, no, you can reconcile them through the cessation of activity. Now, he adds that there is a discipline which enables us to do that, which is Zen. He doesn't go into detail about what it is. Part of it is meditation. I have a cousin who's a Buddhist, and every afternoon around 3, he disappears, he retires for about half an hour. And I asked him, you know, what happens? He says, I empty myself for a half an hour. You know, I jokingly with him said it was just a power nap, but he said, no, it's actually a conscious process of emptying my mind of feelings, judgments. And he has all these exercises that help him to do that, positions he takes, postures, things to think about, he says he's making progress in moving towards not being an individual, you know, which he thinks is a good thing. And Persig actually says this was actually a creditable part, so he has some sympathies with it, and he's not a Christian, of course, as far as I know. Okay, how about where are we? Nick or read from but one day to the end of the text.
But one day in the classroom, the professor of philosophy was blithely expounding on the illusory nature of the world for what seemed like the 50th time, and Phaedrus raised his hand and asked coldly if it was believed that the atomic bombs that had dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were illusory. Professor smiled and said, yes, that was the end of the exchange. Within the traditions of Indian philosophy, that answer may have been correct, but for Phaedrus and for anyone else who reads newspapers regularly and is concerned with such things as mass destruction of human beings, that answer was hopelessly inadequate. He left the classroom, left India, and gave up.
I remember reading that when I was a young man. I was a rather new Christian, and I recognized something that Oz says in his, I think, his very first book, which is The Dust of Death, in the chapter The East No Exit. You know, you can't live with illusion. And he used the Hindu Sanskrit term Maya, you know, which means something like illusion. Means more than that. But he said he gave the example of a woman whose child had died, you know, and her comforters were telling her it's Maya, you know. She refused to be comforted. Her child was dead.
I think it's sad here that he said the professor smiled.
Yeah, it's awful, isn't it?
I mean, you know, Yeah. Like if he teared up, you know, like this is true and it's just all.
Yeah, no, you know, that's the opposite of his answer.
He smiled.
Yeah.
That's creepy.
Is this, I mean, the question's here, why did he react? Is his reaction fair? Is it just a young American who doesn't understand the culture? Or is his reaction innately human?
So, and was his reaction any different from Auden's?
I was just going to say, this is back to Auden. Yeah, I think it's innately human. Again, this cousin, I'm very fond of him, and we have discussions, and I asked him once about the essence of Hinduism being detachment, and how is that going to help? Because he's a very reform-minded person. He's he's head of the religion department at Texas Christian University. He's a Hindu. But he started a charity, you know, that everybody loves. And I said, you know, how can you be charitable if the world is an illusion and you're trying to be detached from it? And he said, well, there's a branch of Buddhism which recognizes charity at a very low level just to help get through, you know. That's the best he could do. He wasn't a crusading, you know, Mother Teresa or something like that. That wasn't his thing.
But he did say that if he ever became a Christian, it would be... He'd be a hard-nosed evangelical. I mean,
yeah,
he realizes that...
Liberal Christianity wasn't much.
You know,
that's right. You did say that, yeah.
He'd be a Calvinist.
How popular today are some of these Asian philosophies in your circles or in your circles? Do you still see young people attracted to this, or was that just a thing of the 60s?
I think, you know, the whole attraction of reincarnation, but changed, you know, combined with Western idea of progress.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the Eastern thinking, but it's some kind of a changed.
You can improve?
Yeah, yeah. Huh. So, but I think the whole new religious movement, attraction, the whole, it was called New Age some years ago.
Oh, yeah, right.
So it's not the same as this. It's connecting Western ideas with this.
Mix and match.
There is still some, you know.
Okay.
We have, for example, in Norway, there are a number of alternative festivals happening and attracting a lot of people. Mm. You may have heard of the princess in Norway. There are two. A son and a daughter of the present royal couple, the crown prince and then the princess, and she is very intrigued by horses, and she talks to these horses, and she has she believes in angels, but angels not as biblical in the biblical sense, but angels in the sense of almost Eastern. So it's some kind of energy.
Yeah.
So and that's immensely popular.
Okay.
Certainly, picking up what you're saying last about the allying the Eastern Buddhist Hindu view with modern technology is something that has been. We know that it's popular because the big budget films present that view. And it isn't that it's popular because the big budget films present the view. It's when they're expending money, they need to know it's going to resonate with the audience. So they produce a story that resonates with the audience. So the George Lucas Star Wars films, where here they are jetting around in their high-tech machines, but they're Jedi Knights, you know. So that story brings the two together. And then more recently, Avatar, when the huge budget of Avatar, and here you've got these characters, this whole sort of, a panentheistic worldview, actually, there. And then you've got the bit at the end where the scientist is trying to understand it and understands it in terms of interconnections. And there are all these scientific analyses of that mystical
view.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, we can have both. Yeah. You know, we can have that neo-pagan idea of you know, of a spirituality, we're all one with nature, and so on and so forth. But we can also be hard-nosed scientists, because we can explain why it is. You hold both of them together. And Avatar holds both of those together, you see. And so I'm convinced, you know, when they're writing the film and producing it all, that they're thinking, we need a story to hang all this thing on that will resonate with audiences. Mm. So often films, the big budget films, tell us more about the zeitgeist of the culture
than the film.
The writers.
Yeah. Interesting.
Is that a new approach to filmmaking?
No, it's always, they want to make money, don't they, at the end of the day. So there are those in filmmaking who are there who are true, what are called auteurs. They've got they're creating their stories because they want to communicate their message. So M. Night Shyamalan is an example of that. He's someone who's an auteur who communicates his message through film. And it's interesting that his more recent films haven't been successful. Whereas...
Well, what would be the name of something he does?
You'd have to ask my team that. They're on top of all that stuff. But what's the more recent?
Slumdog Millionaire.
No, M. Night Shyamalan wasn't Slumdog. No, he did things like Oh my goodness me, the supernatural ones, the one where they're locked away in the village and then they find that actually they're just outside of a main road. What's that one? And Sixth Sense and those sort of ones. But so there are those who are making films because they want to communicate a message. But the big budget films, you know, it's a big team of men in suits who decide what's going to be and what's not going to be, and they've got to make sure that it makes the money back. So you're after stories that will resonate with the world, with people's minds. You know, you don't want ones they say, oh no, I don't like that story. You know, they need to go along with it. So it tells us a lot, I think, about what is the popular kind of worldview. And Avatar is exactly what you're talking about there, Lars, so that, you know, it's that spirituality
plus technology
brought together. Yeah. And it's very popular for people. I can have my cake and eat it. I can be a hard-nosed scientist, but also be a very spiritual person.
Interesting you should say that, because, you know, in our racket of apologetics, there's a theme that says that idolatry often comes in pairs. A faraway God and a nearby God. You see this in Jeremiah, the fates and these little statues, or in Paul at Athens, the unknown God, the altar, and then these little altars, feeding grounds for God, where they have to feed him. And I was just thinking, this Avatar thing, it has the faraway, mystical, new age sort of feel good stuff, and then the technological things where they transform themselves, and they what Dick Kies says, who has a brilliant essay on this, is that the faraway God is a perversion of trust, which was supposed to be the way human beings acted. The nearby God is a perversion of dominion, trust and dominion. Dominion is where God entrusts some control of the world to us. And when we do it right, we get the cultural mandate and replenishing the earth and all these things. When we do it wrong, we get idolatry to a safe, faraway God. We can trust him because we don't know what's going to happen next. And we have a perversion of dominion into a kind of manipulation of the world, which becomes a manipulable God. And I think Zen seems to draw us to this faraway God and draw us into the trust of that. But the victim is no dominion, no real stewardship of the earth, and so inevitably it's going to be impractical on its own grounds. Mm-hmm. It'll just fall on its own grounds, and that's, I think, where Pirsig, Phaedra was reacting against something, not just as a Westerner but as a human being. You just can't live with far away nothings. So another, you know, consideration of evidence, which we all are, I'm sure, very familiar with, and it's a longer text, so we don't have to read the whole thing, is by C.S. Lewis, one of my favorite essays of his, where he defends the uniqueness of Christ. by presenting us alternatives which don't fit the evidence, basically. Let me start it off. I don't need to introduce CSS, I don't think, to most of us. What are we to make of Jesus Christ? This is a question which has, in a sense, a frantically comic side. I love his imagination. You know, who's going to start off a sentence like that? For the real question is not what we are to make of Christ, but what he is to make of us. The picture of a fly sitting, deciding what it is going to make of an elephant, has comic elements about it. But perhaps the questioner meant, what are we to make of him in the sense of, how are we to solve the historical problem set us by the recorded sayings and acts of this man? This problem has to reconcile two things. On the one hand, you've got the almost generally admitted depth and sanity of his moral teaching, which is not very seriously questioned, even by those who are opposed to Christianity. In fact, I find when I'm arguing with very anti-God people, they rather make a point of saying, I'm entirely in favor of the moral teachings of Christianity. And there seems to be a general agreement that in the teaching of this man and his immediate followers, moral truth is exhibited at its purest and best. This is not sloppy idealism. It's full of wisdom and shrewdness. The whole thing is realistic, fresh to the highest degree, the product of a sane man. That's one phenomenon. The other phenomenon is the quite appalling nature of this man's theological remarks. You all know what I mean, and I want rather to stress the point that the appalling claim which this man seems to be making is not merely that made at one moment in his career, and he goes on to say that throughout his career, he claims to be God. And we all know the wonderful text. What do you think of his opening foray here? What do you think of the, his first shot? Would this fly today? Somebody said, "I want to know who Christ is." And you said to him, no, you really want to know what he says you are.
It'd have to be a different place on the journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably.
But it still is a very important message to Christians.
That's what I was going to say.
The trouble is, there are so many elements of us that are not redeemed from culture, one of it is that whole idea that we set ourselves up as a judge. I mean, there are so many modern songs I just cannot sing. You know, there's one of those songs. What's the blessed thing that says, "You are worthy of our praise." Mm-hmm.
Oh, you sound like Bill Edgar.
Yeah, my favorite one to hate is, "Here we are to serve you. Here we are to worship you. Here we are, you know." Here we are, Lord. Lucky you.
Yeah.
I'm here for you.
Yeah.
Help.
Yeah. We're setting ourselves up to judge God.
Mm-hmm.
But then with non-Christians, you can't. You've got to start from where they are. You have to make judgments. But once you've realized who God is, goodness me, the rightful king, the rightful ruler in this world, in our lives.
But maybe there will also be another side to this. You know, actually, someone believes this. You know, here is someone saying this.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that we actually need to think about who Jesus is?
Mm-hmm.
So not sort of asking someone to agree with it.
Yeah.
But saying, okay. What are the possible implications of this if this was true? You know, say so. Well, at least we have to hear who is this Jesus. So that would be a different route, you know.
Yeah.
Not taking the message that is said as the important thing in a way, but the truth of it by saying as what if.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take the example of Paul's conversion.
Yeah.
He met the risen Lord.
Yes.
And had to take that. Because he was going around with a very different judgment
yeah.
of all what was going on, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And
all of a sudden he met Buddhism. That was a different. He came through the way Christ met him.
Yeah. No, that's right.
In his tracks.
Right. Mm-hmm. I love that story, and of course, Paul, steeped in Judaism, was already beginning to recognize that Christ was who he was, because he said, "Who are you, Lord? You know, that I am persecuting." He knew he was onto something different. Jesus.
I like this. Yes, Lewis talking about an elephant and a fly.
Yeah, that's where he does it, right here.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, Christian or not Christian, you have to listen to that because it's so like.
Yeah, it's compelling.
Ritual, it's sort of like a film, right? He's done a film here.
That's
with
right.
Words.
I'm really sorry. I have to go. I have to be. So I'm not going to be rude.
It's okay. We'll miss you.
Great.
Well, we left out the right message, didn't we?
Yeah.
We snuck in the gospel here, right?
God bless you.
All right. Thanks. Okay, what about his statement that most people love his ethics, but they're rather surprised by his theology?
Certainly what I was taught in the 60s.
Yeah.
Church.
Yeah. He was a wonderful moral teacher.
Nice guy. Might want to pattern your life after.
Yeah, yeah.
But Paul was a bigot. Thank you, please, and forget the rest of it.
Yeah. I mean, that there's a lot of iterations of that in popular thinking. The one that made a lot of splash about 5 years ago was the Da Vinci Code. Mm. I don't think we hear much about it anymore. But the premise was the pure Christ was somebody who's been veiled by the church and the Roman power and whatnot. And so he was just a wonderful guy, human being, had children. And the church doesn't want to hear of it. So Lewis makes the obvious point that his theology is just as appalling as his ethics, if you think about it. And you can't separate them.
And it's interesting, there are very few people who are utterly negative about Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there are, I think, a few. But
yeah, Russell was one, but he's about alone.
Yeah. Most people think there is something very attractive about Jesus in some way or another.
Yeah.
Maybe the church has got it all wrong, or maybe theologians have sort of, changed Jesus to, as you said, Bill, to compared to what he supposedly originally was.
Yes.
But still there is this magnetism. Mm. So there is a fascination about Jesus.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I don't know if you're aware of the speaker here last year, Becky Pippert.
No, yeah, we know
Becky Manley Pippert. Out of the Soul Checker, Into the World.
That's one of my favorite books.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. And she's just written a new evangelism resource that has been launched in UK. It's called Uncover, and it's actually taking 7 scenes in a different stories from Luke's Gospel.
Hmm.
And the idea is to uncover who is Jesus. What are the evidences? So throughout the series, people collect evidence. Mm. This evidence is this, you know, the alabaster flask, for example, is one of the evidence, I think. And what is the overall picture that is given?
Mm.
And they printed first, I think, 20,000 copies in Faith.
Okay.
In August of September, and they had to reprint another 20,000 in October, and a third 20,000, I think, in December. And now we're launching this in Norway in August.
Is it mostly Christians reading it, or
no?
Not at all. A lot of people. That's
and great. It's for seeker, you know, Bible study.
Yeah.
So Jesus continues to fascinate people.
Yeah, that's great.
So one needs to have that kind of the uncovering of who he is.
Yeah. We have this very sentimental, but amazingly done Christmas show every year in Radio City Music Hall in New York, and it's full of Santa Claus and everything, but the last scene they reconstruct the nativity with people and live camels and everything, and then they recite this poem about the solitary individual, and it goes on into
this lonely, solitary individual was greater than all the parliaments that ever sat, and more powerful than all the rulers who ever ruled, and so forth. It's all wrong, but it shows the fascination of people with Jesus. He's just not going away, and they're attracted. And we have a friend who was in the dancers at Radio City are called the Rockettes, and they're these amazing dancers who have to do, you know, kick steps in perfect unison, and they train for hours and hours and hours. And she's a Christian. There's a bunch of Christian Rockettes, and she was telling us that a new owner came in to direct Radio City and the Christmas program. And
Jewish man.
Jewish guy, Jewish, secular Jew, not a practicing Jew. And he said, you know, let's just take this scene out. It's so sentimental. And
it's a little difficult to have live camels in New York City for a month.
Yeah, well, that's right, they do. They keep them somewhere, some zoo. I mean, it's a very extravagant program. And our friend was one of several who argued him out of it based on purely pragmatic grounds. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to lose your audiences. They come for this. Okay, so he kept it. So anyway, yeah, as you say. Okay, you know, I think we're familiar with these examples, but maybe some of them could come from you. What are some of the examples that Lewis or any of us could bring up which show that not only did Jesus claim extraordinary status for himself, but that his moral teaching would be cruel and culpable if he weren't who he said he was? So what are some of these examples? We all know them, but it's good refreshing. Good to be refreshed. I can remember my father saying, Jesus was a really good man. And I pulled out some of these things and said, well, I don't like that part. He couldn't have said those things. Well, I mean, one is right at the beginning of Mark, isn't it, where the lame man is on the stretcher and he's brought down through the roof while Jesus is teaching. And Jesus says, my son, your sins are forgiven. That he was doing fine until that, you know, he was probably teaching some great stuff. And suddenly people realize he's not a great teacher. He's claiming something absolutely, utterly different.
So can we go back then, because of that example, of the conversation a moment ago, why we are attracted, why the world still attracts us? It's as if we want an example of a human being living so well,
yeah,
morally. Here you have that in Jesus, but they're not interested in this divinity claim. That's ludicrous, because he's just like one of us. He's just one of us. We like the fact that he's just one of us, because look how he shows us how we can, should live, but also can live, because look, he did it.
I think that's right. But you can't, you know, a careful reading will show you just, you can't do that, yeah. I've always been intrigued by why the Apostle Paul in Acts 17, at the end, talking about the resurrection, says that God has assigned a day where he's going to judge the world by a man whom he's raised up. Now, Jesus was truly man. Some people forget that. But why did he pick that attribute at that moment? Why didn't he say, God's going to come and judge you, and Jesus is God, and you're going to be terrified?
I think it goes back to the, you know, the beginning of the story.
Mm.
Because that's in verse 31, you know, the text.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, before the actual speech, in verses 16 to 21, you have the background to the whole, you know, Paul being introduced. And then, of course, Jesus is misunderstood in various ways.
Yeah, right.
As, you know, just someone picking up things and, you know, the spermologos kind of thing. And then also talks about that he was misunderstood, as if Jesus and the resurrection were two gods.
So it's Jesus and the Anastasia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's the male Jesus and the female goddess, the resurrection. And I think that's one of the reasons why then Paul says, no, by a man, though it's not just the distant gods.
That's exactly right, yeah.
And then it also relates to the Greek myths or legendary material on beforehand, where there was, when was this or these altars to unknown gods erected? They were erected at a time of sickness or plague, according to stories. And then there was also, because the story was that the gods, showed their wrath over Athens by sending this sickness. So how should they then please the gods?
Mm-hmm.
Well, by making offerings to the gods.
Even though you don't
know
who
he is. But
how
do you know that you have made offerings to all gods?
That's right.
Well, you have to make a safety precaution also to an unknown god.
Yeah, that's great.
So the idea of a judgment is actually already there in the Athenian context.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, the Stoics.
Two of five possible alternatives.
Yeah, right. No, I think that's right. I mean, I think the Stoics understood that there was an accountability.
Yeah.
And then to call it by a man, that's to be very threatening. Yeah, thanks. That's very helpful. There's so many other places where one of my favorite places to quote is where he's arguing with the Pharisees, and they're saying, well, we have Abraham as our father. And then he says, before Abraham was, I am. I mean, this is, if you were a first century Jew and heard somebody say that, it wouldn't just be, oh, that's an interesting grammatical lapse, you know, because I am is the name of God in Exodus, and he was very consciously using that. And then his final point is about how extraordinary is the resurrection. I don't know, he heard somebody say, the importance of the resurrection is that it gives evidence of survival, evidence that the human personality survives death. He says, no, it's the defeat of death. It's not a survival. He's Lord over death. I once was at a debate where we were pitting a liberal theologian against a conservative one, and the debate was on the subject of the empty tomb. And the conservative guy did as best he could to show that the empty tomb couldn't have been because his body was stolen or he was drugged or anything like that, but because he had to be who he claimed he was, and it was the resurrection. And the liberal guy answered, he said, you know, I think you're right. I believe in the physical resurrection. Really good point. And then he went on to say, of course, the resurrection is springtime, and it's when husbands and wives get reconciled, and resurrection is when the new day is dawning. You know, so he was making the resurrection anything but what it was. It was newness and hopefulness, and Lewis nails that down.
What did the audience? How did the audience react to this?
Yeah, I mean, the audience was largely Christian, so they were expecting the liberal guy to say something like that. They weren't quite expecting him to say the physical resurrection even was true, but it didn't matter to his theology whether it happened or not, as long as spirit of resurrection was true. So the final thing, what are we to make of Christ? There's no question of what we can make of him. It is entirely a question of what he intends to make of us. You must accept or reject the story. You just can't say, oh, he's really an amazing guy. Even, Lewis doesn't go into this in detail, but even his moral teaching actually doesn't make sense unless he is who he says he is. I remember in another essay in Bertrand Russell's book, he's one of the few people who thinks that Christ is disingenuous. And he says, one of his examples is turn the other cheek, you know, which he doesn't understand in the context, but he says, anybody who would tell his followers to turn the other cheek, you know, obviously has a bad plan for them. He's a kind of a sadist. And how would you follow somebody like that? And what he's got right is that it is stupid to tell people to turn the other cheek. It's really dumb. Unless it is that Christ is who he claims he is, and you're bringing the gospel in by an intrusion into a world where you all you know is revenge. So okay, so this the final text in this Trinity form, and there's so many rich ones here. Is one that I dearly love. They're just about all Christian there and leading people to the faith. And I've seen people become believers based on this section here. I think it's the very last one. The testimony of Helmut von Moltke. And Europeans remember the von Moltke family as being noble, but people who stood up against the Nazis, and mostly to their peril. And he's in his last weeks of life. He's in a prison, and he's writing to his sweet wife. It's one of those remarkable letters. Bonhoeffer wrote a couple, and Václav Havel. So here he says, "My dear heart, first I must say that quite obviously the last 24 hours of life are in no way different from any others. I always imagined that one would only feel shock, that one would say to oneself, 'Now the sun sets for the last time for you, now the clock only goes to 12 once more, now you go to bed for the last time.' None of this is the case. I wonder if I'm a bit high, for I can't deny that my mood is positively elated. I only beg the Lord in heaven that he will keep me in it, for it is surely easier for the flesh to die like that. How merciful the Lord has been to me, even at the risk of sounding hysterical. I'm so full of gratitude that there's hardly room for anything else. He guided me so firmly and clearly these 2 days. The whole room could have roared like Herr Fleischer." This is a story within a story. "And all the walls could have shaken, it would have made no difference to me. It was truly, as it says in Isaiah 43:2, when thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee." That is your soul. "When I was called upon for my final statement, I almost felt like saying, 'There's only one thing I want to mention in my defense. Nehmen Sie den Leib, Gut, Ehe, Kind und Weiß.'" Well, I'll translate. This is, the line in A Mighty Fortress. They put it here. "And though they take our life, goods, honor, children, wife, yet is their profit small. These things shall vanish all. The city of God remaineth." But that would have harmed the others. So I only said, "I don't intend to say anything more, Herr President." What do you make of this opening part of the letter? And is he just starting to become delusional because he's going to die? Or is there something very profound here? What was his frame of mind? And notice the date also.
It's a very firm conviction that comes through, isn't it? It's a very grounded person. You know?
I know.
It's like the anchor of life is solidly thrown somewhere, and it will not even be rocked by death. Mm. It's a very moving piece.
Mm. the hold of the invisible world on his Holy Christ, on him, is very, very strong at this moment in him to me.
Mm. It must have seemed to him too, I never want to be in this position, but it had to become obvious in those horrible German prisons how absurd and fragile in its own way the Reich was, because it had become that way. And compared to that, how utterly solid is the gospel. So there was probably also a observation of the way things were, and you know, at least apparently. There's a wonderful French composer named Olivier Messiaen who was put into prison, and he writes extensively about it during the Second World War, and he survived, unlike von Moltke. But he writes about how silly some of his guards were. Some of them were very generous and kind to him. But there was nothing convincing about what they were doing, and that helped him in his faith.
Jesus had obviously come through for him. He mm-hmm. said the last couple of days, there was a note of authenticity. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a big disconnect between
God. No, that's right.
Should believe, but obviously Jesus had come through for him in an incarnational way in the last 48 hours, or else mm-hmm. he couldn't have mm-hmm. made that testimony to his wife.
Mm-hmm. What's the significance of saying, I'm surprised this wasn't a dramatically different day from the others, but it was, I thought I'd be thinking, this is my last meal, my last night, but I don't think, this is a day like any other day. What's the significance? You know you're going to die. How could you say that?
Because the day is not the last day.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, because there is something beyond death.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think so.
And that's what I meant by the hold of that on him.
Yeah, so right, yeah. Right. Yeah. So it just makes the day relative. It's just it's like a day. Yeah. Yeah.
It puts the day in its proper place.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's right.
We get it around the other way around. Mm-hmm. It'd have been this existential all the time.
Mm.
Where the day, this day, is the important
and
day, et cetera, et cetera. Not in the whole frame of God's scheme of things of eternity.
Mm. Now, this doesn't make him detached, like, Pirsig's hero's teacher. Because in the next paragraph he says, now there's still a hard bit of road ahead of me, and I can only pray that the Lord will continue as gracious to me as he has been. Thanks also to yourself, my love, for your intercessions. Thanks to all the others who prayed for us and for me. Your husband, your weak, cowardly, complicated, very average husband, was allowed to experience all this. It's hard to believe he was any of those things. If I were to be reprieved now, which under God is no more likely or unlikely than a week ago, I must say that I should have to find my way all over again. So tremendous was the demonstration of God's presence and omnipotence. He can demonstrate them to us, and quite unmistakably, when he does precisely what doesn't suit us. Anything else is rubbish. So what's the significance of that paragraph? What does he mean by, if I were reprieved now, I should have to find my way all over again?
Seems like he's, at least for me, that he's experienced in a greater way something of the tangibleness of our relationship with God and God sustaining him mm-hmm. in a way that he had not experienced quite to that depth in the past. And to go back,
he fears that it wouldn't be there. Yeah,
that's what I suspect.
Yeah, I do too. And compare and contrast his view of himself with the amazing confidence in the first paragraph.
And the confidence he has in the first paragraph comes mm-hmm. from
his weakness, and I think so. Yeah. It's like the Apostle Paul. So let's look at the I don't know what page it is for you. It's the one where it says continued January 11th. The decisive phrase of the trial was, Herr Graf, one thing Christianity and we National Socialists have in common, and only one. We demand the whole man. I wonder if he realized what he was saying. Just think how wonderfully God prepared this, his unworthy vessel. At the very moment when there was danger that I might be drawn into our active preparations of a putsch, it was in the evening of the 19th that Stauffenberg came to Peter. I was taken away so that I should be and remain free from all connections with the use of violence. Then he planted me in my socialist leanings, which freed me as big landowner from all suspicion of representing interests. Then he humbled me as I have never been humbled before, so that I had to lose all pride, so that at last I understand my sinfulness after 38 years, so that I learn to beg for his forgiveness and to trust his mercy. Then he lets me come here so that I can see you standing firm and I can be free of thoughts of you and the little sons, that is, of cares. He gives me time and opportunity to arrange everything that can be arranged so that all earthly thoughts can fall away. Then he lets me experience to their utmost depth the pain of parting and the terror of death and the fear of hell, so that all that should be over too. Then he endows me with faith and hope and love and with a wealth of these that is truly overwhelming. And then your husband is chosen as a Protestant to be above all attacked and condemned for his friendship with Catholics. And therefore he stands before Freisler not as a Protestant, not as a big landowner, not as a nobleman, not as a Prussian, not as a German. All that was explicitly excluded in the trial. Thus, for instance, Speer. I thought, what an astonishing Prussian, but as a Christian and nothing else. The fig leaf is off, says Herr Freischer. Yes, every other category was removed. A man whom others of his class are naturally bound to reject, says Schutz. For what a mighty task your husband was chosen. All the trouble the Lord took with him, with the infinite detours, the intricate zigzag curves, and suddenly find their explanation in 1 hour on the 10th of January, 1945. Everything acquires its meaning in retrospect, which was hidden. So, can you summarize what he's saying there in that paragraph?
Now, there are many ways of describing all of us, you know, by status, by social class, by different belongings, sympathies, whatever. And all that is irrelevant here. But it's only... He's there as a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
That's very powerful again.
And it's only when God took all those things away from him.
Yeah. So it reminded me of Philippians 3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he said something about all this rubbish, didn't he, once?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's
the same wording. Quoting. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's quoting.
Maybe it is. Yeah. Wow.
And also, one feels really drawn into the whole, resistance against Hitler with Graf Stauffenberg. And all
yes,
that,
yes.
It's drawn into it in a very powerful way.
In the interest of time, skip the next paragraph, although it's a beautiful one and talks about missing her and sharing communion with her. I just wept a little, not because I was sad or melancholy, not because I want to return, but because I'm thankful and moved by this proof of God's presence. It's not given to us to see him face to face, but we must needs be moved intensely when we suddenly see that all our life he has gone before us as a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, and that he permits us to see it suddenly in a flash. Now nothing more can happen. So what's the significance of that? He's not saying that there won't be anything new in heaven, I don't think. But what does he what's he mean by now nothing more can happen?
Well, all during life, you know, as you get older, whatever, you're confronted with the what ifs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't, is what if this happens? What mm-hmm. if that happens? What if God allows? Mm-hmm. You know, but somehow towards the end, they're not any more what ifs.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going to happen.
He won't need the special guidance of pillar of fire and pillar of cloud. Nothing new can happen except seeing God.
And that's very liberating.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
Fear.
Absolutely.
God's providence is gone.
Dear heart, my life is finished, and I can say of myself, He died in the fullness of years and of life's experience. This doesn't alter the fact that I would gladly go on living. It's again Philippians there, huh? Mm. And that I would gladly accompany you a bit further on this earth. But then I would need a new task from God. The task for which God made me is done. If he has another task for me, we shall hear it. Therefore, by all means, continue your efforts to save my life. If I survive this day, perhaps there's another task. I'll stop. There's nothing more to say. I mentioned nobody you should greet or embrace for me. You know yourself who is meant. All the texts we love are in my heart and in your heart. But I end by saying to you, by virtue of the treasure that spoke from me and filled this humble earthen vessel, the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with you all. Amen. And he did.
Somehow the letter got to her.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was. It did happen.
I know, but sometimes
they were censored and all. Yeah.
It seems as if, you know, it's very. It's definitely not fatalistic.
That's very important. Yeah.
Because he's saying, you know, it might be another task,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but we don't know.
Yeah.
So please continue save, you know, the efforts of saving my life, because there might be another task there.
Mm.
That's very powerful.
Again, like the Apostle Paul, he said, I'd rather be with the Lord, but maybe I have more to do here, which in his case he did.
So in a sense, he's at that moment in his life living most rightly in the two worlds, the visible and the invisible. We see him quite clearly in their value, both rightly. He's able to live in that tension quite well, quite strongly.
Mm.
Yeah, but for him there weren't two worlds. It was just it was one world.
Yeah, but he was living in this world by saying, if there's another task,
exactly.
I'm open to it.
That has value.
Yeah.
I would like.
Yeah.
It's okay to do that.
Yeah.
Okay to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would love to be with you, sweetheart.
Yeah.
If that could be tomorrow.
Yeah. So he was neither a Zen Buddhist, which would be just blending the two, nor was he a fatalist, because I've got to die, I might as well do it right. Yeah. The whole story, it's worth reading. There's a couple of good biographies, and his these letters have been published, and they're beautiful letters, all of them. It's interesting, isn't it, how many significant thoughts come when you're in prison. You know, I guess it's the that little room that Pascal said we want to avoid, but Paul, we mentioned Paul.
Well, Mother Teresa said that. I read somewhere that she went to some prison in Italy, and she said, it's not a bad thing that 800 people are there. You know, amazing things happen. Just think, you have time to think.
Chuck Colson, who just left us, had some of that. Bonhoeffer, yeah. Okay, any final comments?
This whole section is called a point to ponder, journeying to arrive.
Well, the point to ponder is just a preface in each section.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Yeah,
but journeying to arrive.
Yes, that's the final section.
That's it's a beautiful title.
It's not just journey for the sake of journey.
There is a journey with a purpose, name.
An end point.
And a goal.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's right.
The other phrase I liked from this was the journey home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because there's so many of us as we get older.
As he gets away from home.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right.
Yes.
The other thing he mentions also about the unity of oneness in marriage.
Oh, yeah.
It's very interesting.
It's beautiful.
He says,
yeah.
I don't even say that I love you. That wouldn't be right. Rather, you are the part of me that alone I would lack.
Mm.
It's very nice how he
beautiful.
Brings that relationship.
Yeah, one flesh.
So your experience is that this is this touches people?
Yeah, I've never been to one on the journey where somebody hasn't been seriously moved by some part of it. Often it's this letter. Yeah.
Was it Oz who strung all this together?
Yeah, with a lot of help from his editors that are mentioned in here, and then the great Peter Edmund, who, you know, was like a little squirrel finding so many of these things.
Yeah.
But to have the...
Yeah, you got to credit Oz with a lot of that, sure.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is amazing. Yes, sir.
And the whole structure of, you know, with questions, answers, evidence, and commitment in that order, and you know, spending enough time on each,
which you need to do,
yeah. And of course, that's something to take with us from, you know, from the whole framework.
Yeah,
that we need to spend time on each of those.
Well, when you're
that's
at
right,
a
in our own
forum,
term.
There's kind of rules about not too many people. I think under 36 people or something, or I don't know. They had
it's a small number.
And then meals
were.
You had to talk about these things during the meal, and there were like only 8 people, so it was a smaller group, so you could interact with each other.
I think as Lars is suggesting, we each need to spend time on each of these sections in our own journal.
Sorry, I thought you were talking
journey.
About
no, your point's good, but
it's important as well with the community and to understand how that works. But I think, as you say, well, also taking it with us in each our own context.
So in my experience working with many young people, they've been led to a commitment, many of them, not all, but many, without any prior steps on the journey. Not enough time.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Not enough time to look at the evidence.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
They've gone right to the commitment.
Yeah. Peter Berger says, Our generation is conversion prone.
Yes.
Yeah. So he doesn't want that.
And for the Trinity Forum event, those non-Christians who come for such an event, and do you have a follow-up?
Oh, we do. Yeah, we're not as good at that as we should be. That's probably a weak link, but we're trying very hard to improve it. So we always follow up individually with the people who come, whether by phone call or letter or whatever. And then what we try to do is to find people in their place of dwelling who are Trinity Forum or just good Christians, and we ask them to follow up with these folks. And, you know, when it works well. And then many of them come back again for other forums. And we encourage them to go to a good church, of course. Because we don't want this to become their church, you know. But that's a point that needs to be developed.
Yeah. So how often would you say Trinity Forums are happening in Europe now, for example?
Yeah, actually it's doing pretty well here. How often is a good question. We're doing one next week in Paris. They have quite a few in Switzerland. They've done a bunch in Great Britain also. One of our very favorite moderators, Prabhu Gupta, regularly leads them in Switzerland. Well, let me lead us in prayer and then we'll go our merry way. Lord, thank you for this journey we've taken, very brief one, and for the extraordinary writers and thinkers that have preceded us from which we can draw. And we thank you also for Oz and all those who labored so hard to put these curricula together. We pray that if it's your will, we could find use for them more than they have been. And we pray that you would bless this ministry as well as the academy. We thank you for our discussion. We pray that you would bind us together here and help us to grow deeper this week with all the teaching and the singing and the programs. We pray that you would give us strength and protect us from ill health. And especially bless John Lennox in his morning devotions. And he has asked for prayer, and he's poured himself into this. And we pray that it would be an effective and edifying ministry for the rest of us. And we lift all these things up to you now in Jesus' name. Amen.